This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's the...
billiard room.
Come on already. We call it the...
The Place to Be.
Yes, the Place to Be. The Place to Be.
Then I shall be there.
Now, it's time. Live and in living color.
The Grandy Man can.
Ugh. Time to play the game!
No, you left me satisfied and smiling. So.
That's what she said!
So why do I want this? I want to make bank, bro. I want to get ass. I want to drive a Range Rover.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be Podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola. Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
Japanese band Oral Vampire. Produced a song called The Repo Man and used footage.
Oral Vampire, huh?
Or Aural. A-U-R-A-L.
What kind of show is this?
Sounds like some Twilight porn in Michael Lynch's collection there.
Oz went on to star in American Pie, of course. Bismarck. No, was it? Bismarck was on it?
Bismarck.
No, who's the other guy I'm getting?
Bismarck. Yeah, he dressed as North Dakota.
There's only one place where the big boys play, and that is in my extra queen size bed. Well, it just happens. What can you do?
Let's talk the fix.
I didn't mean much to shock wall.
Is that the Shockmaster's wall?
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I'm just curious. PTB Nation, let me know what
you're doing. Here's
our opener. To do worse than Josh Richard.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be Podcast. I'm your host, Justin Rosero, coming at you here tonight, and we are very excited because we have a very interesting, highly anticipated show for you, one we've been waiting a long time to talk about. Before we do that, let me bring in my longtime PIC, that is Scott Criscola. Scott, how are you, sir?
Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 387 of The Mothership. 387.
Yeah, baby.
Wow.
And by the way, excitement
with Dusty Wade by the end of his by the end of his run.
Excitement in the air, Scott. Thanksgiving week always thrilling. One of our favorite weeks of the year. Of course, the day before Thanksgiving, one of the say it every year here. I think for 5 years in a row, one of the best days of the year is that day. You know, you get out of work wherever you are, get ready to go. Nice long weekend. Lots of stuff going on. We got Thanksgiving. You'll be in here for, of course, the annual day after Thanksgiving party we have. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
We're going to play maybe a little football Sunday. We'll see how the weather's looking and how things are going. Yep. Maybe see a little Creed. I've got a lot going on. I'm very excited for the weekend.
Yes, always am. Upcoming. Yep, indeed.
But we are not alone tonight, sir.
No.
Because with us, we have a guest, and this guy was live.
Somebody you don't want to be alone with. Oh, wait, no, what?
he was live in the building the night of this show. Of course, mm-hmm. he is on the PTBN staff, one of our marketing associates, and he is the man who went on the Today Show earlier. And announced that he gave Aaron George HIV, and that is John D'Amato. Johnny, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm always alone, unfortunately. And I'm not winning. Never winning.
So, D'Amato, you were in the house in the Manhattan Center. So we invited you on here to give the live perspective of our show tonight. But first, how are you doing, my friend?
Thanks. I'm great. Thank you, guys. Okay. It's a pleasure to be on. It's a lifelong dream. Another one off the bucket list.
That's right. Oh, you've been with us before, haven't you, on one of these?
Well,
you were physically
vault,
challenged by Giante.
Really?
You've never been here for a vault? Nah, not in a vault.
Wow.
So weird. I'm losing my virginity, yeah.
I guess so. You know, sometime you're going to do it.
Again, well, actually the first time. Let's not get into that.
John, of course, has been a longtime fan with us since very, very early. Do you remember, like, when did you discover the show? Was it within the first few, or was
Yeah, it was definitely like within the first like 5 or 10. I was always looking at Graham's site, and I'm like, what the hell is this? You know, what the hell are these vaults that I could listen to from pay-per-views from the 80s? That's like, you know, that's like a dream come true. So.
And our awful first few shows didn't turn you off?
Well, yeah, you know, I went back and caught up, and
You said that? Those awful shows. Well, yeah, they were pretty awful.
They were. They definitely were awful. We'll revisit that more, I'm sure, in the coming weeks. But Scotty, why don't you let us know what exactly we are talking about tonight?
Oh, tonight is a show that...
Hey, what is going on here?
Oh, what's going on tonight, you don't want to be in here for, so you can just go. You know, I say it a lot, but I honestly do mean it tonight. This is one of those shows that that you and I have been looking forward to vaulting for a very, very long time, because it easily is one of yours and my top 10 probably favorite shows ever. And watching it today confirmed it for me again. Because tonight is not just any ordinary show. We get together for a little extreme reunion.
And not just because he was in the house, but anything extreme, D'Amato has to be there for.
Exactly, so of course.
Very fitting. He's an extreme man himself. So.
Yes. So tonight, inside the Vintage Vault, we bring you ECW One Night Stand 2005.
Thanks for not saying extremely old.
No.
But I guess those are coming. Yeah.
Something's coming.
Not directed my way, but... yeah, this is a show that... came out of nowhere. I remember when it was first announced. I'm like, wow, this is kind of funky. And we'll talk about that era, that moment in 2005 where, you know, nostalgia started to kick in. And, you know, this was a huge moment for the company because for the first time, they kind of handed the reins over to somebody else, which mm-hmm. never happens. So, now, D'Amato, did you hop on this immediately? Were you, like, thinking about it? When it came out, did you get tickets immediately? Was it hard to get, or did it sell out?
No,
quick?
Definitely not. I wasn't as up to date on things as today. Different times back then. I usually work Sunday, so I didn't really wasn't really on it. I usually get the pay per view for free from my buddy with the illegal cable would tape it. But a coworker of mine, something we could all relate to. A coworker that we only have two things in common in the world. We both had the same job, and we both like wrestling. And we would always talk after Raw. And he came up to me and he said, "Hey, I got these tickets to the One Night Stand. Are you in?" I'm like, "Hell yeah!" He said, "Tickets are a yard or whatever." I said, "Hey, I'll turn some tricks, do what I got to do, but I'm in. I'm there." So somebody else was on the ball, and I lucked into it. And it turned out to be a great thing.
Mm. I remember trying to get them early on, and I don't remember the prices being too bad, but. But they ended up selling out pretty quick, I remember. But
it was rough because there's not too there's only a couple thousand in the building, so I think like the lowest is like 100. They were like 100, 150 and 200 as far as that. So. But from what you remember, at the end of Judgment Day, like they had like the promo for it like next month, and mm-hmm. was that pretty much the first time that. That they talked about it or they previewed
maybe?
It?
Maybe?
I have some info here we'll cover in a second.
Oh, okay.
When they cover it. Because I had forgotten too, because they didn't really talk about it on the show. They were just,
no.
When you rewatch it, it's in such a vacuum. Well, kind
yeah,
of.
From what I remember, all of a sudden at the end of Judgment Day, it just popped up, that preview. It was like, holy, it's like next month.
Yeah, because Cole and Taz definitely did mention it during Judgment Day, so.
Right.
I don't even think they mentioned Vengeance either, if I remember correctly. So, all right, June 12th, 2005, live from the Hammerstein Ballroom in beautiful New York City. And with that pay-per-view, at that moment in time, the state of New York and the state of California were tied at 17 pay-per-views apiece.
There you go.
Your attendance, as you mentioned, D'Amato, 2,500. The buy rate, 0.81, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
And your announcers, well, we'll get to them in a minute, because they are part of the early notes. Since titles really aren't part of the picture, I'm kind of looking forward to the Sutton Report for this, because champions are irrelevant on this evening. What do we got, JR?
All right, well, the concept for the show came from the mind of Rob Van Dam, who pitched the idea to Vince McMahon. Playing a role in the decision was the overwhelming success of the Rise and Fall of ECW DVD that was released back in November 2004. They moved 22,000 copies in the first week and was a few thousand copies away from being the biggest selling DVD in history. So when RVD went up to Vince, that combined with the DVD sales, he was able to tip it in his favor. He said, "It was my idea, actually," and this is all from an interview that he did over the last couple of years. "It was my idea to do the ECW pay-per-view. That process involved me going back and forth to Vince every day for a while with different ideas. He said, look, you've got all these wrestlers on your payroll. They used to be in ECW. Let's do a reunion show, and it will be awesome. You've got Eddie Guerrero, Rey Mysterio, Chris Benoit, Spike Dudley, and I gave him a huge list. And he goes, I didn't realize that. You don't have to bring anybody in. Just let us do what we want to do one night only the way we want to do it. And he went for it. Fans, of course, were worried that the show would be watered down, but Paul Heyman vowed, or they were that Heyman would have nothing to do with the show, but of course he vowed if he was involved that they would do it the right way. Tommy Dreamer was put in charge of organizing the show and booking the talent. Heyman was giving full control of the night. McMahon would be present at the show in the gorilla position, but had very little to say over the product itself. In addition to ECW wrestlers that were booked, Dreamer and Heyman brought in old referees, ring announcers, and even the security team that worked the ECW shows to bring add to the feel of the show. And there were many legendary ECW fans at ringside, including Hat Guy, our buddy Vladimir, and the Faith No More guy. In the weeks leading up to the show, there was a serious question about who would handle commentary duties. It was leaked that Mick Foley would be part of the team, and there were rumors that WWE was trying to bring in Joey Styles. Styles had always sworn he would never work for WWE and refused initial feelers, but days before the event, Styles caved because he did not want to miss out of the reunion. It was a major coup because Styles added a lot to the broadcast, and it would not have been the same without him. And I'll pause here. I got a bunch more notes, but who else could they have legitimately had in the spot if Joey wasn't available? Do you think Paul would have done it? I mean, I feel like he was busy backstage. You know, Gertner. I mean, who do they bring in to call the show with Mick? I mean, I'm guessing Mick would do it, but. I mean, maybe JR just because he has, you know, he has like street
that
cred.
I think that would have been. Well, yeah, but not this cred. I think that if it wasn't Joey. I wouldn't say they would have canceled it, but I mean,
I think it was legit like days before that he agreed. So
yeah, I don't know what they would have done. Paul, I guess. And maybe they would have got that guy, Buffon, the guy that sat front row. Maybe he would have handled stuff backstage because Paul trusted him. So,
or Tommy, just Ron Buffon backstage, maybe.
Or Tommy. Yeah. Yeah. I could see Paul and Mick.
What do you think?
With, like, Tommy and Cole, the guy Buffon.
I guess just Cole and Taz is you know, the only thing I could think of, but we wouldn't have the same cachet.
That would have been great because Cole would have got the shit kicked out of him.
Yeah, I feel like JR is the only one that maybe, like, from WWE world that would have had, like, the cachet or the name to, like, at least bring credence. Like, he probably would have treated it well, you know?
Right. That's possible.
I don't know. It's probably a good thing Joey caved. Maybe they were probably pretty confident that he would cave. So Heyman was given full control. McMahon did want some involvement to ensure that fans unaware of ECW's history had purchased the show, so he gave instructions to have members of Raw and SmackDown invade the program to fulfill his wishes. So we'll talk about that, of course. Do you remember what this was sponsored by?
Destroy All Humans.
Yes, very good, THQ. And do you remember the song? It's pretty obvious.
Let the bodies hit the floor.
Yeah, Drowning Pool again.
Yep, very good. Yep. The Alliance song. They had to squeeze that in one last time.
So, I wonder if they were expecting Stephanie to do commentary.
So we do have a championship roll call, and this is from the last champions of ECW. Rhino, of course, was the final ECW heavyweight champion, had defeated Justin Credible and our buddy Steve Corino in a TLC match, a TLC and C match, a guilty as charged January 7th, 01. ECW TV champion, also Rhino, had defeated Kid Cash in September 9th. And our tag team champions, Danny Doring and Roadkill, had defeated the FBI December 3rd, 2000. So those are your final champions. ECW and TNN ran 59 episodes in the last year that they were on TV, finished on 9/20/2000. ECW Hardcore TV ran 401 episodes across 7 years, closing up on December 31st, 2000. Final show at the ECW Arena was Holiday Hell on 12/23/2000. The final two shows in the history of the promotion ran on January 12th and 13th, 2001, with the final match being Sandman defeating Justin Credible. And, of course, the night before this show, Shane Douglas put on a hardcore homecoming at the New Alabama Sports and Entertainment Center in Philadelphia. Chris Chetty and Mikey Whipwreck defeated C.W. Anderson and Simon Diamond. Tracy Smothers defeated Blue Meanie. Two Gold Scorpio defeated Kid Cash. The Bad Breed defeated the Gangstonators. Jerry Lynn defeated Justin Credible. Raven defeated Sandman. And Sabu survived a no-rope barbed wire match by beating Shane Douglas and Terry Funk. Paul Heyman tried to convince Vince McMahon to use New Jack, but it was unsuccessful. We'll get to this last couple of bits as we move along. Terry Funk not at the show. He had vowed loyalty to Shane's version and decided not to come to this one, even though they tried to get him. So people wondered exactly what they would have.
Right. You mentioned that Guilty as Charged show. You talked about the three title matches, some of the others. It's funny because you said Tommy Dreamer and C.W. Anderson, that match was at Guilty as Charged. Mm-hmm. I Quit match. The main event, Rob Van Dam and Jerry Lynn.
Yep.
So the main event was not even a title match. 24 and a half minutes was the main event. Yeah. Apparently, Scott Hall was supposed to be at that show. In fact, Time Warner and In Demand ads were pimping him, and Paul Heyman had them pulled. So.
On 5-9, Eric Bischoff referenced an upcoming one-night stand pay-per-view and claimed he would squash ECW like a bug. A week later, Tajiri and Chris Benoit agreed to compete in an Extreme Rules match, but Bischoff stopped it and banned anything ECW-related from Raw. He also proclaimed that he and a group of Raw superstars would invade the pay-per-view. On 5/23, Bischoff had planned an ECW funeral, but Mr. McMahon interrupted that and spoke of his past financial support of the promotion. Paul Heyman then came out and said he was in control of ECW and welcomed Bischoff's invasion before lighting a funeral wreath on fire. Finally, on 5/30, Benoit Edge competed in a tables match, which Edge won after numerous Raw superstars came down and assaulted Benoit. On 6/6, Benoit was wrestling Snitsky when Tommy Dreamer led Rhino, Axel Rotten, Balls Mahoney, and Sandman, amongst others, to the ring, where they assaulted the Raw invaders. Switching gears on the 5/26 SmackDown, Kurt Angle said ECW is a low-class organization and announced that he would lead a SmackDown invasion of the pay-per-view as well. The next week, JBL joined the cause, and Angle tried to convince Taz to join him, but Taz turned down the offer. Angle responded by assaulting Taz and left him bloodied in the ring. On 6/9, Benoit faced off with JBL, and Benoit with the ECW Originals in his corner. JBL had the SmackDown invaders in his. A huge brawl triggered and brought the show to a close. In addition, while multiple matches were announced on Dirty.com, the only pay-per-view billed on weekly TV always featured the invaders. So not a lot of just ECW standard stuff. And like I mentioned, we didn't know a ton heading in. We knew some stuff, but not a ton. Matches announced here and there, not much build. So you know, we talked about it, an amazing concept, pretty shocking comeback. I thought it was pretty brilliant that they did it in Hammerstein with the old school look and feel. They didn't try and, you know, jam it in a big arena and play it up like that. I thought it was cool how they brought down so many of the players like we talked about, and it seems so unlike WWE, Scott, like you mentioned, which was crazy. So, and I like the legend that Vince was sitting there in Gorilla soaking up the show. So Joey Styles does open the show. Pretty surprising moment to see him out there. He has some tears. He gets choked up during the intro, and the crowd is just on fire. Foley comes out as a color announcer, and I thought that was a nice choice due to his strong ties and obviously knows the history of the promotion, knows what they're trying to get across, and is just a pretty good announcer in general. So it worked out well. John,
and what made it even better was that, and I mentioned it, we talked about it today in a couple of our chats, that when Foley came out to his Cactus Jack music and not his Mankind music, I knew that that there, and I mentioned it that, and I thought about it when I watched it then, that, okay, this is legit. Because I thought Vince would be like, oh, play the Mankind music. And, you know, ugh. But when he came out to the Cactus music, you realize that, okay, Vince is kind of, you know, loosening the reins for the most part on this night. And that was a big deal. I thought that was a huge deal for those aesthetics that he came out to his Cactus Jack music.
John, what was the emotion like there when Joey was doing this?
Oh, you could just see it, like, on Joey's face. That said it all. Just the ECW chants and him just, you know, fighting back the tears. That was pretty much how, you know, how the whole crowd felt. It was just electric.
And that definitely came through on the TV too. Him getting choked up, and you know, that's like the moment it felt real. Like, oh my God, Joey Styles is out here talking, and look at this arena. And like even up until that point, you still weren't sure what it was going to be and what they were going to do and just how ECW would be. Like, you just kept waiting for the shoe to drop, and it really didn't. I mean, a little bit, but not really. So why don't you take us to our opener here, Scott?
Okay. Oh, before we do that, JR, did you want to do a little history of Hammerstein or no?
You know, we got a lot to cover. It's okay.
Okay. Anyway, it was a quick thing. Built in 1906 by Oscar Hammerstein and was home for his Manhattan Opera Company. 2,200 for reception theater style, 1,000 for seated dinner. Could you imagine people sitting and eating dinner there? It would be funny. And imagine? And 3,500 for standing in concerts, and it was renovated in 1997, obviously. ECW, a bunch of other things were there. Jane's Addiction recorded their 97 Halloween show. NASCAR held its end-of-seasons award ceremony in 2002. Iron Maiden performed there. It's amazing all the different bands, from Jane's Addiction to Bryan Adams to Patti LaBelle to Korn to Iron Maiden to the Pixies to Kylie Minogue to 30 Seconds to Mars to Swedish House Mafia to Paramore. It's just amazing the different kinds of acts there. So anyway, that's where we are. And of course, the first Raw was there. Okay. Our opener immediately old school ECW feel for a couple of reasons. Number one, the two guys were both there. Number two, they were a former tag team in another promotion. Number three, both of them dressed for the occasion. JR, why don't you give us the background on these two gentlemen? Well, we don't need the background, but these two guys in general.
Right, so Lance Storm versus Chris Jericho, the final mainstream match of Lance Storm's career. He had gone into semi-retirement in 2004, returned for this reunion. After the show, he made the indie rounds in different capacities, would compete in a few matches here and there, and continues to run his wrestling school, make local appearances, very active on Twitter with his, you know, book club and reviewing Raw and everything else. So still pretty active in the community, doesn't really wrestle. I think he's had maybe one or two matches since. Final pay-per-view record, 4-11, lost his first 7 pay-per-view appearances before finally winning at Vengeance 2002.
So he went 4-4 after that. So at least he batted 500.
I'm surprised he had 7 appearances between June 01 and June 02. I mean, that's not bad for him, really.
Yeah. Well, he had the feud with Edge for the IC belt, and then he was on a lot of the combo matches, I suppose. So.
Also, Justin Credible's final WWE pay-per-view appearance. After the show, Credible made a brief stop in TNA and MTV2's WSX. Jeez, I forgot about that.
Oh, God.
He would return to WWE a year later for a brief stop, and then that run would be short-lived. Continues to compete around the New England indie circuit, capturing the BTW Heavyweight Championship from our buddy John Walters in a match where Ric Flair was a referee. Credible also inducted to the New England Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame in the summer of 09. And, of course, these two guys, very long history together, having met while training at the Hart Brothers Wrestling Camp, had their debut match against each other in 1990, and also teamed as the Thrill Seekers in Smoky Mountain. And now they close up shop here for Storm's career against each other as well.
And Justin Credible almost stole Andy Flanagan's lighter.
That's right, he did.
Hopped in the back of the Buick Eldorado and almost ran out of the bar.
If Andy was in the shape he's in now, he probably beat the shit out of him.
Exactly.
So a good opener with strong backstory ties. Dawn Marie's out there with Lance Storm. That's a nice touch, of course. She was with him and Justin Credible as the Impact players. Jericho has his old school lion tamer tights, and that's awesome. And he kind of got it right away, knowing to do that. Foley notes that Lance Storm stated this could be his last match. You get some basic mat work early. Crowd is just biting on everything. You get a vintage crackcore chant for Dawn. You get Jericho doing the baseball slide, but he eats the railing on the dive outside. Storm hits a perfect dropkick and a great delayed suplex for a two count. Jericho dropkicks Storm in the back of the head and gets a tiger German suplex for an air fall. Storm comes back with a super kick. Storm gets a single crab. Jericho survives and gets the walls. Dawn provides a distraction. Incredible and Jason show up. Credible cracks Y2J with a cane and gives Storm the win. And I was surprised by that finish. And that kind of shows that the results here were pretty much going to be in a vacuum because Jericho was in the middle of like some pretty big stuff on Raw. And to have him lose to a guy who's basically retired was pretty surprising. I like the nice Impact player celebration after the match. And it's a good opener in that it had like some good wrestling and had some good spots, but it also was basic enough to let you soak in the atmosphere and the concept. Like they didn't come out of the gate firing with some like wild ECW style brawl that immediately just sucked your attention. This kind of gave you the chance to, you know, alternate between the match, looking around at the crowd, soaking in the chants, like, you know, the crowd getting warmed up, doing the crackcore chant, getting into everything. You could just feel it all building. And right away you get the feeling too, okay, not only are we going to see the guys in the matches, we're going to get to see guys interfering, guys at ringside, and you know, you got the feeling that you're going to see more than you were initially told you were going to see. So, John, what did you think of this match and kind of everything to go with it?
I loved watching it back. My favorite part was like after the first minute where they were exchanging, you know, some moves, arm drags, and Foley was saying, "Oh, the fans, you see, they appreciate good mat work. They're not like those bloodthirsty animals that they're." And before he even finished the sentence, the "she's a crackcore" chant started. So that was that was what's good to set the pace. And then then Styles was going off at the end saying, "Oh, that's a crappy way to win your last match." But you know, it was just a good solid opener, you know, just to warm up the crowd, and you know, this is a good match.
I can't believe they dug Jason Knight out of mothballs. Yeah. Well, last time we saw him, good grief. But Foley, and he didn't do it as much.
He looks like he ate a bunch of mothballs.
Well, that too, but he didn't do it as much as the show progressed, but I'm like immediately the self-aggrandizing started. And, you know, I think I should get some credit for getting Chris Jericho in here because, you know, he was kind of floating around in Mexico. Oh, for Christ's sakes. Man,
yeah, I'll talk about that. I got a lot of notes on that later.
God, it was just so aggravating.
And I love Mick. And I think he's a good announcer, but that was a running theme throughout the show where, and maybe he just didn't have the stories that like Joey had, but this relates everything back to himself in his career. Everything back to himself.
Yep.
We'll cover that. I got a bunch of notes on that. So,
Yeah, it was just it was really bad there. I didn't notice it as much as the show progressed. I know he did it a few more times. Mm-hmm. This match, though, like the match is barely 90 seconds old, and he's already like, yeah, I remember back when for fuck's sakes. So, but the match itself was fantastic. I mean, both guys worked hard. Jericho looked great with the old line and the vest. I think mm-hmm. the vest was I think he got that in Mexico, if I remember the Jericho DVD or his book, one of the two. And it was fantastic. I mean, Storm looked like he hadn't missed a beat if he hadn't wrestled a match since June of 04 or whatever.
Right.
I mean, he looked fantastic. So, I mean, top notch. While you were waiting, before we continue on, D'Amato, and before, like going back, like when you guys were just in the crowd, just milling around, like what was the buzz? Like, was everybody really like pumped, like near, you know, near like the concession stands and just walking around the building? Like, did they have that feel where was anybody skeptical going into this?
No, and then after this first match, it felt like everything changed. It was 100% positive. It was really there was nothing mm-hmm. negative at all as far as you know, not even a chance. It was just, and it's so unique because I really don't remember like any of the matches being like announced. It was just that everybody was just there to have a good time, and it was 100% positive.
Yeah, I think they announced. I feel like they ended up announcing most of them, but it was just on the website. Like I remember. Like the week of the show, all of a sudden they had a post up that had like six matches listed, and you're like trying to absorb what the hell's going on when you saw them all, you know?
Yeah, but it was so unique. It was like the wins and the losses weren't going to matter.
Right.
It was just such unique as far as, you know, the matches themselves. It was more about the work and you know, and the show, and not so much the wins and losses. And that's why it was, you know, one of the most unique pay per views of all time.
It's like the greatest exhibition show ever ever created. You know where
I know.
Most times shows like that don't, you know, whether it's like a tribute Raw, SmackDown or some of those lines, you know, it feels a little just bland.
Yeah, yeah, like a very special Raw, like a very special Raw, but, you know, extra special there. Mm.
So Styles mentions that the Raw and SmackDown stars vowed to crash the show and put ECW out of business again. And we see some empty seats up in the balcony teasing that. We get a video package for the ECW stars that passed away, and that includes Chris Candido, who had just passed away. It was like a week or so, or was it a few weeks before the show? Actually, it was April, wasn't it? Was it April?
It was like a month and a half.
Yeah.
Something like that. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's in there. A very sad package. But they did a good job even capturing the ECW video package style. Like, it wasn't slick at all. It was very rudimentary and even had, like, mm-hmm. that weird kind of... Well, I don't know if the music that was on the network is the one that was originally aired. I couldn't remember. John, you watched the original version, right?
Yeah, I don't remember the music.
It was like a slow jazzy. It was almost like a... I don't even know how to explain it, but
it sounded like something Vince would pick.
No, see, I didn't think so. It felt very like mid-90s ECW-ish. It was like,
yeah.
I don't know. It was like grungy feel.
Yeah, but also, I mean, among the guys,
there was about 10 different guys.
Obviously, Pitbull number one, Rocco Rock. Crash obviously, Johnny Holly. Grunge would pass away after this.
Yeah, Crash Holly.
Crash Holly. Terry Gordy. Who's Mordetsky? Was that Christian York?
No, it was Mike Lozanski.
Lozanski. Who was?
Yeah.
I don't think that was his name?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think his name.
And Big Dick Dudley.
Big Dick Dudley, yeah.
Yeah.
I like Big Dick myself. PDB Nation. Big Dick Dudley and...
Original Sheik.
I miss you, your cousin, your nephew, Sabu. That's right. They actually put that on the screen. And then it ended, yeah, as JR said, they ended with Candido, which was only like a month and a half before.
Yeah, it looked like he was usually Mike Lozanski or Mike Anthony. He wrestled that sometimes.
The only guy that I realized they didn't put there, I don't know if there was any, not that it's a criticism, but one guy I thought was in there and there wasn't was Spicoli.
Right.
I thought they'd have put Spicoli in there. I didn't even think.
Yeah,
I forgot they didn't.
Weirdo. So Candido passed away April 28th.
So yeah, about a month and a half. Yeah.
And Gary Wolf Pitbull introduced the video. He was one of the Pitbulls in Pitbull 2, like you mentioned. Anthony Durante had passed away, and he was actually passed away here in Rhode Island. Kind of a effed up story. In 2003, they found like him and his girlfriend or whatever dead, and the kids were still in the apartment with the dead bodies. They overdosed or something like that. It was a really, really screwed up story.
They all died. And if you noticed in that package, they almost all of them died in 2003. It was like of the eight people they mentioned, I think seven of them died in 2003. I think Rocco Rock died in 2002. And obviously since then, Johnny Grunge had passed away. But I agree. It was a very like grizzled package, and I like that was another thing about the show, the graphics and everything.
And there was a huge Candido chant after he was the last one, and it was a huge chance for Candido.
Yeah, because you know he's someone that definitely would have been there.
Oh yeah.
Well, I'm he was with TNA at the time, so maybe not actually. I mean, it wouldn't have been because he was managing the Naturals. So, all right, Scott, what's our next match here?
So, yeah, that was a nice little package. Next up, we have a match, again, goes back to original ECW, calling it a three-way dance. It was not, Joey describes when they're getting in the ring that this is not typical WWE triple threat match rules. This is called the three-way dance. The three guys are, and they have, well, at least one of them, well, no, two of them have been in WWE before this moment. One of them, of course, Tajiri. One of them, we know him as, of course, I can't remember what his
Nunzio.
Name was. Nunzio, thank you. And, of course, he's here as Little Guido. And then the third guy is a guy that's, I don't think he's ever been in the company. He does join later, and that is Super Crazy. And it is a three-way dance. One of them came in with a manager, JR, amongst some other guys. Give us the details.
Yeah, James Mitchell finally makes his WWE debut as he accompanies Tajiri to the ring. Mitchell briefly competed in Smoky Mountain before turning attention towards managing. Migrated to WCW in 1996, becoming heavily involved in the Blood Runs Cold angle, managing Mortis and Wrath. After a creative team ran out of things for him to do, he was sent home and paid for 2 years. Moved to ECW in 2000 as an evil priest dubbed the Sinister Minister. Managed Tajiri and Mikey Whipwreck until the promotion folded. He would move on to TNA before being released in 2008, and now he runs like a karaoke business, I believe, in Florida or something.
Could you imagine? The Sinister Minister sings REO Speedwagon.
I think I'm friends with him on Facebook. I feel like he like just shaved his head, too, or something crazy. I don't know. Also making his first appearance alongside Tajiri is Mikey Whipwreck. Mikey began training in 1993, eventually signed with ECW after a referral from Joey Styles. A natural underdog, Mikey would be involved in some memorable storylines, especially one where he teamed and feuded with Cactus Jack. During his time in ECW, Mikey would hold the TV, tag, and heavyweight titles. In 1999, he jumped to WCW, but his stay was brief, as he was upset with his lack of push. He returned to ECW in late 99, teaming with Tajiri and Mitchell. After ECW went under, Mikey bounced around, spending some time in TNA, ROH, and various indies. In 2010, he was having serious issues stemming from neck injuries, leading to numbness in his limbs, and was unsure if he'd ever compete again. He also claimed he was offered a trainer position with WWE, but unsure if he would ever accept due to injuries, and I don't believe he ever did. He was one of those guys that was like a big, pretty questionable jump to WCW. There were a bunch of them, but he's one. It's like, I get they all went for the payday, but like, what was he really expecting when he went to WCW? Like, what were they going to do with Mikey Whipwreck at WCW? I could maybe see him fitting in WWF in the Attitude Era a little bit, but he was just like the epitome of an ECW guy.
Yeah, I don't even think he would have fit like with the Cruisers. Probably not, you know?
No, that's what they tried to do. Right, and that's what they tried to do with him. But I don't know. Just they didn't know how to handle him. You know, that's such a uniquely built gimmick. D'Amato, were you a big Whipwreck guy? Did you, you know?
Nah, unfortunately, a lot of the guys that went to WCW were a disaster from ECW. It's like, geez. You know, Sandman, a lot of those guys are just...
Hack.
Was it going to work out? Yeah, was it going to happen?
Yeah.
No, definitely not.
No.
So, like you mentioned, Scott, this is Super Crazy's WWE debut. Crazy began wrestling in Mexico in 1988, the age of 14. In 1997, he had a brief stop in WWF as Super Loco before moving to ECW under the name Super Crazy. Crazy had a solid run in ECW, winning the TV title and had great matches with other wrestlers. When ECW folded, Crazy worked the indie scene as well as touring Japan and Mexico and actually signed a deal prior to this pay-per-view and would move to SmackDown after the show. So he was inked and then held off to debut here because I think... Didn't he have like a broken arm or something when he signed? Like he had just hurt it in the indies? Because I feel like here he's got it wrapped and then he was good to go when SmackDown started. I feel like that was part of the reason they held him off.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so too.
The FBI, the Full-Blooded Italians, were formed in ECW in 1996 as a comedy group consisting of African-American wrestler J.T. Smith and Big Val Puccio. They eventually added Southern stars Tommy Rich and Tracy Smothers, who helped perpetuate the joke, as well as Little Guido and Big Guido. The group would act as stereotypical Italians, despite most of them clearly not being Italian. The group eventually became more serious and was pared down to Guido, teaming with Tony Mameluke. It was managed by Big Sally Graziano.
Loved Sally Graz.
Mameluke and Guido would win the ECW tag titles and hung around till the promotion closed. Smith, Smothers, Mameluke, and Guido all accompany Little Guido. Big Guido all accompany Little Guido to the ring here for this match. I like that he dropped the Nunzio name for the show, that he went back to the Little Guido Maritato. This is a vintage ECW feud as well, this three-way. These guys had a lot of battles, so it was a good idea to put them back together. It was cool seeing Tracy Smothers out here on a big stage after the long, great career he had. Never really got a shot like this. Immediately fast-paced out of the gate. Crazy gets knocked to the outside. Guido works on the arm looking for submissions. Crazy gets back in, rattles Guido with a stiff dropkick to the face. Crazy gets a moonsault on both and sets up for a dive to the floor. But Tony Mamaluke trips him up. Match spills to the floor into the crowd. Crazy scales the balcony. It's a huge moonsault into the FBI as the crowd is going crazy for the first big spot of the night. Back inside, Tajiri gets a tarantula on Super Crazy. Crazy gets tripped up by Smothers and pummeled by the FBI on the floor. Big Guido comes in, but Tajiri missed Little Guido to block a double team. Mikey comes in, hits a whippersnapper off the second rope, and Tajiri eliminates Guido. Tajiri then hits a tornado DDT for a near fall. I thought Foley's good here, Scott. This is where I really start to feel he's starting to relate everything to himself with all, you know, I'm the hardcore legend, and, you know, like he kept referencing that. Crowd behind Super Crazy as he made his comeback, hits two moonsaults before Mikey trips him up. Crazy avoids a buzzsaw and hits a powerbomb and top rope moonsault for the win. Anticlimactic finish, I thought, a little bit. It was a really fun sprint, though. I expected a bit more, but I'm guessing they wanted to save it for later, so they don't want to empty the tank here. Good throwback, and it felt like a greatest hits match with some interference from everyone to kind of get everyone involved. So, Scott, what are your thoughts? And then, John, I want your thoughts on the match, but also on the big spot from Super Crazy.
Well, I loved that they got as first off, it was great that they got all those guys. I mean, JT Smith, you know, urban legend. He is the originator of the "You Fucked Up" chant because his, you know, obviously his gimmick in old school ECW was trying to do something and completely screwing it up every time. I did miss the iconic fat fuck, Big Sally Gratz. He was always one of my favorite guys in the old FBI, so I was kind of bummed they didn't have him. But the match is ridiculous, as expected. They all went crazy, and literally. I was wondering if obviously Super Crazy already had a job. As did Guido. I was wondering if, and my teacher's still there, so obviously all already employees. Mm-hmm. So you knew they were going to kind of go that extra mile and take it to the next level. It was an incredible match. You know, tried to fit as much as they could into 6 minutes because obviously match lengths were not a big deal on this night because I'm sure there was, you know, obviously there was a lot of in between stuff, promos and vignettes and stuff. So lengths wasn't a big deal. It was a fantastic match. Johnny, thoughts on the match in that spot?
That Super Crazy moonsault. That was like the first real explosion of the night where, you know, everybody, ECW, holy shit. You know, my buddy that was with me, he was like jumping all over me, high-fiving me, you know, just going crazy. But also a couple of funny things from when I'm watching back from the commentary. Joey Styles was like, these guys aren't even real Italians. He goes, Tracy Smothers asked if an innuendo was an Italian suppository.
I forgot about that, yeah.
And he goes, referee John Finnegan's got to officiate this match, that poor bastard. And Styles was pretty funny. Right? Yeah. But it was confusing at first because I was like, I thought it would be like a tag team triple threat. But then, you know, Super Crazy came out alone, so... You know, like I said, because the matches weren't really announced, it was a little confusing. But that moonsault, that was like the first big explosion of the night where the fans just lost their minds.
Yeah, it was an incredible match, and seeing all those guys there, JT Smith and all those guys, it was pretty awesome, definitely awesome.
So we get a video package from there, looking at ECW memories from the early years of the promotion. So,
another question: I wonder where 911 was at this point. He's still alive. He hasn't died, right?
Right, yeah.
I couldn't find him.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't bust him out for anything.
Yeah, he's an easy guy to find, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, Matus was one of those guys that wanted nothing to do with the business. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. And that was that the video package? I know one video package they did the Austin's Monday Night Quill where the big boys play with each other. I don't know if it's this one or the next one. But
I think it's later. They do one that's like famous moments. This one was kind of like the early stuff that felt like.
Yeah, the night the line was crossed and you know, when Shane throws the belt down, when Beulah says she's pregnant, mm-hmm. I think that's on that package. Yeah, some good stuff, good early stuff. Right. Next up, though, here's where we get that, and I'm definitely looking forward to Johnny's thoughts on this mm-hmm. one and what the live feeling was. We go old school Lucha Libre, or at least we thought we did, and that is the matchup between Psicosis and Rey Mysterio. Back then would have been Junior. Of course, they battled in, you know, late 95, early 96 with some crazy matches. A little bit about Psicosis here, JR.
Yeah, Psicosis, that guy. made his debut in 1989, working the Mexican scene for the early part of his career, would make a brief name for himself in the U.S. when he performed on When Worlds Collide pay-per-view, and then capitalized on it with a brief stay in ECW. We had a great three-match series with Rey Mysterio. Both men moved to WCW in 1996 and would feud on and off during their time there. Psicosis had a solid career in WCW, and that included losing his mask in a match with Billy Kidman. After being released in 2000, Psicosis spent time in ECW, TNA, Mexico, before signing with WWE in 2005, along with Super Crazy, so another guy that was inked to a deal heading into the show. And again, another throwback feud with two old rivals, and you said the Mexican death matches. Psicosis has no mask, and not the prettiest looking guy, and we'll talk about that in a moment. No. Rey makes the first major faux pas of the night when he comes out in his WWE gear, his WWE theme, the look, like, didn't try seemingly at all. Did not try at all, it seemed, to get into the spirit of what they were going for. And I don't think he did it maliciously. I just don't think he was probably thinking it through, not realizing what may happen to him to show up like that. We'll talk about more about that in a second as well. So we get some trading of holes early as Styles talks about their history and background. Crowd chants for Psicosis to put his mask back on, which was a bit rough, I thought. Psicosis rolls through a cross body and spikes right down. Rey gets a near fall with a moonsault press. And this is really the quietest the crowd had been all night. I thought they finally cooled off a bit. Psicosis hooks a sleeper and then chucks Rey to the floor. Psicosis shoves Rey into the railing and hangs Rey across it and then follows a leg drop off the top. And that was a great spot that woke the crowd back up. Psicosis whiffs with a dive to the corner. And Styles wonders if he's taking too many chances and being over-aggressive due to the pressure on him in the show. Psicosis misses a charge in the corner, flies to the floor. Rey hits a seated senton off the top rope into the crowd to win the crowd back over a bit. And then he pisses them off with the 619 and West Coast pop to get the win. Fine match. I thought it was a bit of a letdown until the big spots came in the flurry at the end. And the crowd just did not seem to care for Rey. And I don't know if it was just him or it really had to do with all of the duty type stuff he had, including, I thought the 619 got like one of the biggest boos of the night when he did that. And it felt like another greatest hits kind of match where they just kind of dipped into their bag of, you know, usual spots and broke them out. But Johnny, what was the crowd like during that match? And was the hate for Rey as obviously as loud as
definitely.
It was?
This was like the first like bit of negativity. Just for some reason, Rey Mysterio in New York, and you guys will see it in future vaults where it gets, you know, a lot worse at, you know, future shows at MSG, where New York just does not like, they're not fans of Rey Mysterio. I mean, and especially you could tell that that's supposed to be his big moves, the 619 and the West Coast pop, and it was greeted with, you know, more like silence than, you know, it wasn't tremendous boos, but just silence. And this is the first of many where you'll see it in New York that they're just not having Rey Mysterio. I don't know if it's a East Coast, West Coast, 90s rap thing or whatever. I don't know. I can't call it, but yeah, they're just not feeling them. This is probably one of the only few moments of negativity, you know, as far as the crowd concerned, on the whole night.
Do you feel like, I mean, do you think the Doty stuff had anything to do with it here, or do you think it was just the crowd didn't care for?
I just think like the 619, maybe it's not like, you know, a believable move when he does it. You know, the guy's like twice or three times. This is not my opinion, but you know,
right?
I mean, I don't mind him, but I think that's just what it is, that they're just not buying, you know, his moveset for guys that are twice and three times his size as, you know, as legit. So, but I can't call it, but you know, we'll see it a lot though, as far as New York goes.
On our old board, JR, somebody had mentioned that Rey was actually wearing an old mask, but I watching it today, I don't think so. I think even the mask was, you know, WWE mask.
Well, even if it's not, you know, even if it is an ECW mask, it wasn't obvious enough to get the point across. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, it wasn't nearly, oh, okay, look at that ECW mask. No, like, it wasn't, I don't know how you'd even tell, you know?
Right. No. Yeah, Rey should have had his tight tights with the, you know, his regular tights used to have the big boots, because his boots used to be really big and high up his leg. And, yeah, it's almost like he treated it like a SmackDown match or something. Like, he had no interest in, I mean, I don't know if it was intentional, but.
I think May just didn't get it.
I just don't think he got it either. You're right. I agree.
And I mean, maybe he couldn't do the tights too because of his knee or whatever. I mean, I get it. But it's interesting.
Yeah.
So,
and the match definitely was not as good as it could have been.
No, definitely not. All right. So the SmackDown Crusaders show up at the balcony to a very raucous reception. They revel in the heat, especially JBL and Angle. I mean, this is like JBL's dream right here. And the SmackDown stars were JBL, Orlando Jordan, Kurt Angle, Carlito, Matt Morgan, and Doug and Danny Basham. And then from there, we go to a video package featuring all the memorable classic moments like you mentioned earlier. And then Joel Gertner, the original John D'Amato, comes out.
Hey. The love muffin.
He comes out to interview the SmackDown stars, and Angle just smacks him across the face, and then JBL shoves him down hard. And this is where you could tell JBL was just, like, in heaven. Like, this is his at his bully freaking best right here.
Dickhead best. Oh,
and not
absolutely.
In a good way, but, you know, just in his environment at this point in his career. Just and like he almost trips over Angle to walk over and shove Gertner down. You know what I mean? Like he can't get over there quick enough to throw this guy down. And like Gertner's like the perfect target for a bully like JBL. His fat slob and his neck brace comes waddling over. So Angle trashes the ECW fans. The crowd chants. This is one of my favorite lines because it makes no sense. Crowd chants, "You suck dick," and he responds, "Your mother showed me how." Which is
beautiful.
It's such an angle. No, it's such an aloof angle response, right? Like to say that. It's like what?
No, he had actually handled it perfectly. It was like they were in that element. Him and JBL, you could tell. I mean, that was.
Yeah, but it's such a goofy thing to say. Like your mother showed me how to suck dick. I don't know. Just said this is funny.
It was bizarre.
But it was a little frustrating because you couldn't hear what they were saying because the crowd was just bananas. And
right.
You know, it was a little frustrating because I couldn't hear what JBL. You know, he was coming off of some good lines, and you know you could barely hear him because it was just it was so loud, man.
And then JBL trashes ECW as well, puts over how big of a star he is, rips the internet nerd fans in their mother's basements. The crowd chants, "Shut the fuck up." JBL, and you could tell JBL again, this is like his dream promo. Yeah. But the crowd, like you said, John, is just ignoring him, booing and chanting over him. And then JBL takes credit for the success of the show, despite him showing up on the show. So we have a little bit of an altercation coming up. Sorry, John, go ahead.
No, he goes, I like this line where he goes, you guys, you know, are home in your mother's basement, emailing your buddies saying I'm hardcore.
While watching porn.
Yeah.
Well, chat your baby.
With no who is.
Yes.
So I just want to mention quickly this guy named Bill Alfonso got into wrestling as a referee in the early 80s, popped up in NWA during that time, would have a run as a referee stint in WCW and WWF before moving to ECW in 1995, assumed a role as a troubleshooting ref that worked for the Athletic Commission and played the heel role, strictly enforcing the rules and rallying against the extreme ways of the promotion. He would then begin managing Taz before turning on him to manage his rival Sabu. He eventually added Rob Van Dam to his stable and maybe the most famous for his bloody brawl with Beulah McGillicuddy in 1997. Hung into ECW till it closed and worked the indies in various roles. And we mentioned him because now we head into a very interesting segment. So Rob Van Dam comes out with his big knee brace on. Bill Alfonso's with him. And the crowd's just going crazy for RVD. JBL's pissed about being cut off. And RVD says it sucks that JBL showed up and is taking credit because it has nothing to do with him. RVD credits the fans and talks about how sick they are of having JBL shoved down their throats. I don't have any creative geniuses writing my script tonight, he says. He talks about how he lived to entertain the fans during his time in ECW. And RVD had been waiting a long time to open up like this. Talks about how he went to Vince with the idea for the show and pitched it, how they only needed one night with no storylines and they'd get it done. RVD was psyched to work the show, but then he got hurt and was forced to miss it. Says it sucks worse than missing an overseas tour, sucked worse than missing Booker T's wedding, and worse than missing WrestleMania. Amazing Bizarre World, where RVD actually gets to speak his mind and rip on guys like JBL. Promo of a lifetime, though, for RVD. Tremendous stuff. You could tell stuff he had been holding in for a long time, and kudos to them for letting him go out there and do it. But, you know, it felt like the guy that gets the one day in charge that's going to get his ass kicked the next day for everything he says tonight. Mm. It's like, all right, get out what you're going to get, RVD, but then we're going back to normal tomorrow. But it was good. It was a really nice, touching moment. It was one of the, again, just like the style stuff from earlier, another emotional moment in a night full of them. And that brings us to our next match, Scott, where as RVD is doing his thing, Rhino comes out. And this is like our ECW segment of the night, right? We go interview right into a match.
Right.
Rhino's final WWE appearance released on April 9th after he got into a fight with his wife during the WrestleMania after party and tore up the hotel lobby. Returned for show only before moving to TNA. He left there and then actually just returned to the company recently to join part of NXT.
Yep.
Rhino's a guy. I want to get your take, both of your takes on this. What did you think of his run with WWE? Because he's a guy that seemingly had more success than you may have thought, but at the same time, not as much as he should have probably had. When you look at his size, his charisma, his energy, never really the same when he came back from that neck injury. What do you think, Scott, of his run overall? What would you grade?
Yeah. I mean, here's a guy who could have been a solid, I don't know if he'd be a main eventer, but I think he would have been a solid U.S. or definitely like an intercontinental champion, and held it for a while. And instead, he was everybody's muscle. Like, he, you know, obviously he came in and right after the original ECW closed, he showed up at WrestleMania 17, and he was kind of hanging around for a while. And then he was kind of feuding with Benoit in 03. He was successful, but he was successful on the periphery. And you wonder why. And he was a guy that, if booked properly, if there was a spot for him in the mid-card on either show, would have been a great U.S. or Intercontinental champion. I don't know if he would have been a main eventer. I don't know if he had that much charisma to be able to be a, you know, WWE or World Heavyweight champion. But I think he would have been a perfect IC or U.S. guy if he had a good manager, if he had a good guy kind of helping him out.
He said it in his promos, like, they only let me say cool and I'm RVD. And so, you know, he never really connected with his promos. I think he was hinting at that when he finally got a chance to let loose, you know, with his promos. So.
No, we're talking about Rhino.
Yeah, what
no,
about
RVD,
Rhino?
I'm saying, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but what did you think of Rhino's run, John, in the WWE? Like, do you think he could have been more?
Nah, I mean, it was about, he reached his potential. That was about what he was as a mid-card guy.
The thing I always liked about Rhino was his energy. Always moving, constant movement, bouncing around, flying around. For a guy his size, built like very uniquely. Like, he was just like a big rectangle, you know? He was just like,
yeah,
no curves, you know, just straight down, like bulky, but like strong, just stout. But never stopped, just perpetual motion. And that initial run he had when he came in around WrestleMania 17 until he got hurt in 03, or when did he get hurt? 02? Maybe it was 02.
I mean, he had a good run with Raven, right? Didn't him and Raven feud over the hardcore title?
Yeah, he was really good in 01. He had the feud with Jericho. He was a big part of the invasion. Remember, they kind of had the sexual stuff hinting with Stephanie. It was like,
oh, yeah.
I mean, he was like, you know, he was in the big matches for the company. No, he had a lot of push, you know, and then he broke his neck and came back, and he got pushed again, but it was just never really quite the same.
The gore was definitely over for it. It was definitely hot for a while.
Oh, yeah, with Heyman screaming it and everything.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's a guy I think that definitely maybe, if he didn't get hurt, I'm curious what he ends up with in 02. But I remember being surprised here when they turfed him, because it seemed like the guy that'd be around for a long time. Then I remember he busted up the flower pot in the hotel lobby, and that was it.
Yes.
So the legendary Sabu makes his pay-per-view debut after a long, violent, prosperous career. Sabu trained under his uncle, the Sheik, cut his teeth in Japan before heading to ECW in 1993, was an immediate underground sensation to his crazy, maniacal matches where he put his body and life on the line. After a two-year run, he hopped to WCW in 1995 for a very brief stay, returned back to ECW in 1996, where he stayed until the company closed. He would make very brief appearances in WWF during their interpromotional feud with ECW in 96 and 97, even competing on Raw one time. He would spend some time in the few indies and TNA before being brought into the show. It would not be the last time we see Sabu on pay-per-view. But a good moment. I'm glad they were able to bring him in. He had to be part of the show, even though he didn't have many ties to WWE. Arguably, do you think he's the biggest, unless I'm missing someone off the top of my head, is he the biggest ECW star to this point that had never been at least some part of his career in WWE?
I
Sandman.
Think so.
Yeah, Mega Sandman's the other one. I'd argue Sabu's probably a little bit bigger than Sandman, but that's a good one, Scott. Yeah, I'd say the two of them are really the two biggest guys that had long runs that had never showed up. They were kind of like the ECW's Sting version, you know, that like long run in WCW never came. these guys. So Rhino comes out, he gores RVD and attacks his knee. The lights go out. Sabu comes out to make the save to a monster pop. What was that like, John, when the lights went out? Did you know Sabu was coming?
Yeah, everybody was cool. Everybody was shouting like 5 minutes before. Everybody was going Sabu, Sabu. So it wasn't unexpected.
So Rhino hits the belly to belly and stomps away. Sabu fights back and wrecks him with a chair shot to the head to knock him to the floor. Crowd chants, "You got fired," to Rhino. Sabu hits a springboard clothesline to the floor. Sabu tosses another chair into the face of Rhino on the floor, and the crowd's just loving this. Sabu puts Rhino on a table, but Rhino pumps up and blocks him. Rhino takes over to back inside, grabbing a near fall. Sabu gets a head scissors takeover off the top and then uses a chair, but Rhino trips Sabu up and spikes him into it. Rhino with a diamond cutter on the chair, and then Rhino goes for the gore, but Sabu pulls the ref into the way. Rhino pile drives Sabu, but RVD comes in and smashes Rhino with a chair and then hits a running skateboard chair drop kick into his face. Sabu hits an Arabian skull crusher through the table with an assist from RVD. The crowd goes bonkers for Sabu getting the win. Longer match than I expected. I kind of thought this would be like a quick one the way it started, but I thought it was much better than I expected it to be. It was a lot of fun. All the vintage spots were mixed in. Sabu's win was a must and a nice way to get RVD involved since he couldn't wrestle. And in my mind, Scott, do you agree that this was the match of the night to this point?
Yeah, this match was fantastic. Short burst of action and hard hitting, and you knew Sabu was not going to hold back. You know, Sabu's one of those guys, you know, he's kind of like the, I guess you could say he's like the modern day Bruiser Brody or Stan Hansen, where he kind of likes going to the beat of his own drummer and likes wrestling where he wants to wrestle. So I couldn't tell you whether or not this was a tryout for him that he wanted to come to WWE, because he didn't seem like the kind of guy that would like to be locked into a big promotion. I mean, he got the cup of coffee in WCW and then kind of, you know, vanished. So I don't know if he just went out because he just wanted to put on a great match. Maybe because they showed his uncle, the Sheik, in the piece. But he definitely showed more than I thought he was going to.
He only knows one speed. I mean, he's pretty much always wrestled the same exact match. Just some nights it clicks, some nights it doesn't. And on this night, it all came together for him. What do you think, John?
Well, at this point, I mean, just the steady flow of the show. I mean, coming out with the bananas, JBL and Angle promos, and just leading into RVD and just leading into this match. It's like the flow is just sick. It's nonstop, and just loving every minute of it.
Do you think this is the match of the night as well so far?
Oh, definitely, definitely.
And surprising to me, just based on, I mean, I knew Sabu would have a Sabu match, but if you looked at those first four matches on paper before the show and you knew it was going to be that order, Jericho, Storm, that three-way, Ray, Psychosis, and then this, I mean, you're probably slotting this third or fourth, right, on paper.
Yeah, but the timing was perfect. I mean, they kept it short, and they got all the big spots in those 4 or 5 minutes.
Plus, you get the RVD emotion.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised. I mean, just watching him, you know, with his bad knee, but he still got in there and did some stuff. So.
And he'd be out for a little while longer, right? When does he return? Is it not till early 06 does he come back, or is it late 05? I guess we'll see. Yeah. I guess we'll see whether is it a Rumble return? I don't remember.
Who's that?
RVD.
RVD?
When does he come back from the injury? Now we'll find out.
I think he's back by the Rumble, because obviously he's at Mania. So yeah, I think it's the Rumble. I don't think he comes back before the end of 05.
All right, well, backstage, Al Snow blames Head for SmackDown invading the show. And this is Snow's final appearance, pay-per-view appearance. He remained under contract till early 07. Mainly used as a jobber and a trainer for the duration of his deal. After being released, he would spend some time with OVW and TNA, as well as other indie promotions. So let's talk about Snow for a moment, guys. Scott, what did you think of his run in the promotion? Another guy that's been around for a long time. I mean, he first showed up in the WWE in 1995 as Avatar. Been around since then, Leaf Cassidy, and then eventually Al Snow. Did the Job Squad, had his brief heel, kind of almost main event run with The Rock and Mick Foley. And then since then was just kind of a hardcore guy bouncing around, did the Tough Enough stuff. A guy, do you think he's one that reached his potential? Or do you think he had a little bit more in the tank than what we saw from him?
I think he had a little bit more in the tank. I liked the heel run in 2000 when he had the cool tights and kind of like the creepy music and like the Doctor Strange looking like bullseye thing on his Titantron. I think there was a little bit left for him. The Job Squad stuff was good, but I mean, in ECW, I mean, the head thing was insane. I mean, people throwing heads in the ring, and I mean, they talk about it a lot on the DVD. It was bonkers. I think there was definitely a little bit more for him to do, particularly during that stretch, the Attitude Era, 98 through 2000, where really anything went. I mean, he could have done a hell of a lot more than he actually did in that run.
And so, he came in with a big rep, I mean, as a great worker. Like, if you listen to some of the Between the Sheets episodes here at PlacementNation.com, I mean, he was having like really good years in the early 90s in Smoky Mountain and other territories. And then, you know, with some of his stuff in ECW, the famous match of Benoit that's on a couple of DVDs. You know, he's had it came in with a lot of hype. And then, like you said, the head stuff really blew up in ECW. So he came in off of that. And I feel like he had a decent start and then really peaked with that Foley and Rock stuff. Couldn't get over the hump. But I feel like he's a guy that maybe they needed someone like that at that level a little bit earlier. And I know he was there as Avatar and Leaf, but not quite enough. By the time he really got rolling, things really, the talent level was picking up that made it tough for him to really continue to evolve. Like, once they got the Radicals, once they got Jericho, you know, that whole group that came in. And then once the, you know, wars ended officially, that made it even tougher for him. What do you think of Snow's run, John?
Well, fortunately, unfortunately, you know, the head gimmick was great, but everything after that, people are just going to associate with the head gimmicks, right? Everything else they tried, everybody's just going to think, what does everybody want? You know, so it was tough to move on from that.
So Snow's done after this. He moves on. So we're back in the arena. And now the Raw Crusaders have arrived, and they are led by Edge and Eric Bischoff, both acting super smarmy, jawing at the fans. Styles jokes that he's glad he didn't bring his wife to the show, of course, a joke at Edge. And then you get this great visual of Bischoff and Coach arm-in-arm, smug, just almost like hugging.
They all look like they just came from like the beach. They were all like all tanned and just looked like some smug dicks, man. You know, all tanned and...
They went to the beach, they drank, they hit the strip club, and then they rolled it here. Like, that's exactly what they looked like. Just like,
yes.
Completely.
Friggin' Edge, I just fucked all your women. And,
Edge just had that perfect, just fucking white trash scumbag. He was perfect. Absolutely. As great as JBL and Kurt were earlier, Bischoff and Edge just were made for this building as heels.
Well, Bischoff... I mean, Bischoff was the face of the anti, you know, him and Jerry Lawler were the two big anti-ECW guys throughout the late 90s. So, I mean, he was the poster boy for everything they hated, right? I mean, he was always the scourge on ECW promos, the guy they talked about, Uncle Eric from, you know, Mankind or Mick Foley's shtick. So, I mean, he was great because he had that cred behind him, and then Edge is just a douchebag. But yeah, I mean, the top four guys between the two brands are real high-level trolling assholes, Bischoff, Edge, JBL, and Kurt.
Pretty much.
And the rest of the Raw guys are Coach, Christian, Tomko, Snitsky, William Regal, and La Rez. So, interesting group there. But cool that Christian tagged along with Edge as well. But yeah, I mean, a great, just great stuff. When I just love that shot of Edge. I mean, of Bischoff and Coach just arm in arm around each other, just like smugly smirking at everyone.
Just like Rick's. It's just ridiculous. Just so ridiculous.
All right, next match, Scott.
Next match, believe it or not, and I had forgotten when Joey said it today that Paul just – one of his dreams that he was never able to make reality was these two in the ring at the same time. And that is a guy we've mentioned a couple times this evening, and that is Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero. Of course, they were both there, but not together. Well, they were together, but they never actually wrestled each other.
Right.
Then they all left in, what was it, fall 95 and headed to WCW. But yeah, I mean, this was one that Paul always said that he never was able to get them together in the ring at the same time. And 10 years later, he finally did.
And it's a good matchup. Sales is an anchor match for the show because you pretty much just a lock. You know it's going to be a great match. The Crusaders all rip Benoit for showing up to wrestle. Eddie really sticks to his dirty dickhead persona. We're going to talk about that in a moment. And at points almost looks completely disinterested in competing. Like, I don't know if it was just him really pushing his new heel act or if he was really pissed off. Again, I got some notes on that we'll talk about. The match never happened in ECW, Scott, like you mentioned. We get some stalemate mat work to open as fans are taunting Edge about Lita with multiple chants. Eddie regroups on the floor as fans come back to the match. Eddie lands some chops and strikes back in the ring. Eddie's bridge of the nose gets busted hard way. Lots of grinding. Eddie wrenches a tight rear chin lock. Benoit busts out some back suplex, but Eddie regains control, goes back to the chin lock, and the match spills outside. Eddie uses a chair and spikes Benoit into a table. Eddie misses a frog splash, and Benoit loads with chops and more stiff strikes. Benoit gets a near fall with the Northern Lights with a bridge. Benoit breaks out triple Germans and hits the diving headbutt for two. Benoit then hooks on the crossface, and Eddie battles for a while before finally tapping out. And again, solid match, but not a classic like many expected. I think you kind of thought this would be match of the night across the board, just based on their recent history with WWE, their matches there. And it felt like they wrestled a hard-hitting, strong style, but they never kicked into the next gear because it was fine. Like, this was a fine tribute to ECW. They battled hard. They were stiff. They didn't really need to go to the next level because of what else was still to come. But again, not what you thought it was going to be on paper. And just some notes here from Sutton. He provided us. So the word is that Eddie thought because he had just turned heel, he shouldn't be doing a clean job to Benoit. So weird, because as you know, he was always very close and protective of Benoit. Weird that he would have been mad. He felt that the crowd was too focused on the invaders and not on their match. And he was, it was also that him and Benoit had a heated argument backstage. So he left the Manhattan Center before the show ended. So, obviously some weird stuff going on with Eddie at this point anyway. And who knows how much of this was him playing up the heel stuff. Like, would you put it past him that he was just, you know, kayfabing everything? Like, didn't want to break what he had worked so hard to cultivate since May when he turned on Ray. You know, maybe he felt like if he came out here and bought in, it would jeopardize his big run on top that he was looking for. So that's my take. I haven't really ever read that or had it corroborated, but just piecing it together, like, Eddie's not the type of guy at this point in his career to really get mad about this stuff. And knowing how dedicated he was to his craft, to me, it just screams that maybe he just pushed the kayfabe and went a little bit over the top. What do you think, John?
Yeah, it was just a turbulent time for Eddie between losing the belt and with his pushes and, you know, who knows, probably all that other stuff that, you know, that came to light of what was going on was probably bothering him. But as far as the match, just once again, the flow and the card placement, like, you know, you get all the craziness, you know, with tables in one match, and then this, you know, was just a, you know, a mat-based match to try to slow things down, and it was just perfect placement of all the matches. That's what I liked.
What do you think of the match, Scott, and then what do you think of that theory about Eddie?
The match was fantastic. If Eddie was pissed off, he didn't, and you know, he didn't dog it. I mean, at least he was a professional in that aspect, because the match was great. I mean, hard-hitting and typical for those two guys. I mean, you could just, you know, it goes back to their match at Vengeance 03. They know each other so well. Your theory actually makes a lot of sense, because Eddie and Benoit were so tight. Why suddenly would they get into a fight? I don't know. I mean, obviously both guys were having, maybe were starting to have their own issues in their own way, and we'll delve more into the Eddie portion of it later on in the year, but I just can't see Eddie being that upset. Now, it was a weird spot creatively, I will say that, because Eddie had just turned heel. And to kind of slip out of it this quickly and then slip back out of it again, what I would have done, I mean, you wanted to have Benoit on the show, but I almost would have maybe had Eddie one of the SmackDown guys, one of the SmackDown invaders. Even if the invader thing pissed him off, if he didn't want to wrestle, maybe make him one of the invaders. If you really want to push your heel persona, be in the balcony. That would make him even better heel, because he's an ECW guy and he's up right there saying, ah, screw you. So I don't know. But I mean, I don't know who else Benoit would have fought. I mean, they could have played up. You could have, I mean, you didn't want to ruin, I mean, Rhino and Sabu was a great match, but you could have played up, because they did show it in the second retrospective piece when Benoit broke Sabu's neck. So you could have played that up. I don't know if Sabu would have tried.
I mean, I think they really wanted to do the Benoit Eddie thing, since it never happened. That was a big selling point for them that they talk about. And
yeah,
that just leads all the credence to me to say Eddie was working everyone. I feel like, I mean, he went along with everything, you know? It's like, yeah. I just feel like it would seem so out of character for him at this point. Like, if this was 99 when he was, like, heavy into the drugs and was pissed off at his life and, you know, all that stuff, okay. But, I mean, by all accounts, like he wasn't like that at this point. So it just seems weird that on this one night he would be doing that. I mean, unless he legit was pissed about jobbing, but it seems so unlike him. And I don't know. I think it was a work. I think he just, I think he just acted that way to get over his character, that almost in a Pillman-esque 96 way.
See, you just took the thought right out of my head. I was just about to say that.
Right, almost like an homage to Pillman's stuff.
Very Pillman-esque, which if you think about it, is pretty awesome.
So. Right. So to me, it screams like maybe it was more along those lines, where he was just working everyone into thinking he was really becoming like a douche, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If there was, you know, a minor disappointment of the night, this was probably it, because a lot of people were expecting like a match of the year candidate. Instead, it was just a solid match, but it wasn't like a match of the year candidate, because a lot of people were souping it up as it was going to be.
Yeah, I agree.
But a minor disappointment, but you know, nothing traumatic. It was still a solid match.
I mean, I think just based on how great the show is, if you had to pick something, I think this is it. I think you're dead on, John. I think this is the one thing that really didn't quite click all the way. Maybe Ray Psychosis is the other one, or just Ray in general. I'd say those two matches are probably the most disappointing on the night.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with that too. All right, why don't we take a break? We got two matches left and a bunch of other stuff as well. John, at this point, you must definitely got your money's worth. Even before we even get to the last two matches, you've definitely got your money's worth, right?
Yeah, that goes without saying. I mean, there's not enough superlatives at this point. It's just an amazing night.
Yeah, it only gets better.
Of course.
But first, many words. Because?
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes at PlaceToBeNation.com. You can check out Scott Criscolo and me on The Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you, including Main Event, which features a roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Phil Schneider's Digging in the Crates, and our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse. And join Pro Wrestling Only's Will and I on the Dangerous Alliance podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to enjoy as well. We feature the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport, led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops, and the TJ McClune Show, featuring great guests from around the world of sports journalism. PTBN also proudly features the Richard the Mailman Podcast, specializing in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows available on PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN also is a home to tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island and Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network. That's the Pro Wrestling Only, Place to Be Nation, Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, Lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds wrestling culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Good Will Wrestling with Good Old Will from Texas.
There's Tag Teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWOPTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
All right, Nation, we're back looking at ECW One Night Stand 2005. Just a really quick overview, PlaceOfNation.com. Heading into Thanksgiving week, as always, we'll have plenty for you. Holiday themed, like we always do. Some past treats, some present treats, some future treats. A lot of Survivor Series coverage. Obviously, was a big show that just went down. We'll have your, if you check now, should be, of course, the reaction show is up for you, plus plenty of other coverage. We had a new episode of the Kevin Kelly Show last week with Ray Rowe. We have a Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast coming this week, main event. Plenty for you as we head into December and out of November. So be sure to check out that. And, of course, as we reach the holiday season, the Amazon link on the right-hand side of PlaceOfNation.com. You go down, you click that, brings you to Amazon, do all your shopping, and it kicks back just a little bit to us. No extra steps, no fees, no extra cost, nothing for you besides just stopping at PlaceOfNation, clicking that banner, and rolling on. So appreciate all your support. Facebook.com/PlaceToBeNation, Twitter place number to be nation as well. So there you go, PlaceToBeNation.com, your one place to be in your pop culture world. So One Night Stand, we are back after Benoit and Eddie wrap up. Joel Gertner returns, visits the Raw Crusaders, and begs Eric Bischoff for a job. And this is one of my favorite moments of the night, where Bischoff's drinking the beer and Gertner's rambling on and then just goes, "Please, will you give me a job?" And Bischoff does this awesome spit take. And Gertner, in an underrated moment, has a stack of headshots that he gives to Bischoff. And Bischoff says no and rips them and then puts himself over while ripping ECW. The Crusaders are here. From this point on, I felt like we just got one too many cuts of them, like all through these last couple matches. And it took some of the charm away. It takes you just a little bit out of the show. Like, it just took me just a little bit, like, all right, we get it. They're there. We're going to get to them in a bit. Like, they start cutting to them, like, constantly.
Mm-hmm.
D'Amato, since you were there and maybe didn't realize it at the time, watching back, was that jarring to you to see that, to see them get so much FaceTime?
Yeah, it was definitely, it made a difference in the show, you know, from the ECW, the history and all that, to now, you know, basically, okay, we got to take care of business and we have to, you know, push the current product, so. It's definitely noticeable when you watch it, not so much, you know, there being there that night, but definitely when you watch it later on.
Yeah,
it definitely
takes you out of those matches just a little bit because they show them. But that the spit take from Bischoff and then the headshots crack me up still to this day. Great work by both those guys, and it was good use of Gertner on this night to have him do that. I guess he was always kind of a sycophant and a suck up. So
yeah, Bischoff called him a scab, and then he went off in the crowd. He said, "You're all scabs." So.
All right, Scott, take us to our next match.
All right, our next match, another one that was memorable in the original ECW annals. This one later on in the year, and first incarnation, and also brought a myriad of controversy for our play-by-play announcer. It is Mr. Mike Awesome, the former ECW champion, taking on a guy that he battled with a few times in 1999 and early 2000, and that was Masato Tanaka.
And this is
not Masa My Hero Tanaka.
I know, right? For years.
Another Tanaka.
So this is Tanaka's debut. So he had made his pro debut way back in 1993, where he competed for FMW, left Japan, headed to ECW to reprise his Japanese feud with Mike Awesome. After a solid 2-year run, he returned to Japan, where he continued to compete at the time of the show. The match marks Mike Awesome's final duty appearance in February 2006. Awesome retired from wrestling, claiming he wanted to spend more time with his family, feeling underpaid for his appearance at the show. And things sadly ended tragically for Awesome when he was found hanging in his home by a group of friends. There are stories that Awesome was driven to this point due to an upcoming divorce and spending time in jail for physically assaulting his estranged wife. And of course, when the time he passed away, a lot of light was being shed on kind of the concussion injuries and head trauma and depression suffered as a result for a lot of wrestlers and other athletes, football players and whatnot. So again, that was a sad end, and we'll, like you mentioned, Scott, a little bit of controversy regarding that in a moment. So another classic rivalry revisited. Awesome looks great since we last saw him. Styles trashes him hard for what he did to ECW throughout this match. The Raw Crusaders turn their backs, which was kind of funny. Fast start by both. Austin with a nice leaping shoulder block and then follows with a big suicide dive, to which Styles says it's a shame he wasn't successful in killing himself. Obviously, in retrospect, Jesus. Feels awful. Styles really took this all personally. And of course, as the legend goes, we've covered here before, Austin left with the ECW title as champion, went to WCW, took a big payday, and Styles apparently never forgave him. For doing that, crowd is just going nuts here. Austin gets dumped into the fans and eats a huge chair shot from Tanaka, and Styles is on fire, ripping TNN as well as Austin. Austin sends Tanaka flying through a table on the floor with an Austin bomb, just madness throughout. Back inside, Austin hits a big splash off the top for a near fall, and Foley's basically like, do you forgive him now, Joey? Can we get past this? And Joey's like, yeah, okay, I'm on board. Austin hits another powerbomb in the ring. They trade disgusting chair shots unprotected to the head. Tanaka hits a blockbuster and gets a tornado DDT into a chair. Tanaka puts a chair in Awesome's face, hits a big elbow onto it with a second chair. Awesome gets a nice release German suplex followed by a spear. Awesome gets another table but looks a bit out of it as he does now. Tanaka blocks him and hits a tornado DDT through the table. Awesome hits a super awesome bomb onto the table remnants for a near fall. Awesome sends Tanaka over the top and through a table with another awesome bomb and then dives on top of him for the win. And the camera angle is fantastic because you don't see him and he flies out of nowhere and you hear the crunch of the table as he just careens into him. Mm. And sadly, he caught his knee on the top rope as he came down and kind of jacked it up a bit. And that's usual, like, shit, Mike Awesome luck, you know. He has this incredible match. Maybe he might get a job, and then he jacks his knee up. Awesome hits a pointless sloppy powerbomb, almost killing the referee after the match. I hated that. Shocking show-stealing match. Everyone was going crazy. The Crusaders were even flipping out during the match. Definitely feel like two guys are showcasing themselves by saying, screw it, we're just going to go out and beat the shit out of each other. A wild garbage match. Full tribute to the ECW style. A little bit tough to watch in retrospect just due to what happened with Mike Awesome, but it fit perfectly in the show. Two guys no longer... It fit in the show, but it also fit the feel of ECW, right? The whole feel of ECW was always two guys... No place to go, out of the spotlight, destroying themselves with the fans. And this was like that throwback ECW match. These two guys, nowhere else to go left in the business. They're showing up in ECW, killing each other. Even though Tanaka was still in Japan, but you know, you get the overall point. D'Amato, what was this like live, this garbage shit show? Had you ever seen anything like it? And what were your thoughts at the time?
My thoughts, when they first came out, I'm like, you know, both of the guys, they don't look like in the best of shape. You think it's just going to be a mediocre match, and then all of a sudden, one banana spot after the other. It's like, are these guys, you know, trying to kill themselves, or what are they trying to do? I mean, what's the purpose? Like you said, maybe are they that desperate for a job? It was like, you know, one sick chair shots, the DDT on the table, and the awesome bomb, and it's like, and the crowd's just eating it up. But then, you know, looking back at it, and especially, you know, with Joey's comments, you know, shame he didn't take his own life. It's like, come on. And then style, and he kept calling him Judas. He's a Judas. And it's like, oh, yeah.
Oh my God.
Just trashing.
But the crowd just ate it up. But years later, it's like you said, what was the purpose? Did these guys think they were going to get a job? Were they that desperate? It was like, you know, it's a little sad in retrospect, but at the time, it was like, once again, the crowd's going banana. Guys are high-fiving each other, you know, climbing and jumping up and down. And just bananas. And then watching it back, JBL's reaction was just like, after after Awesome got the pin, JBL's reaction was priceless. He's just like, oh, my God, I can't believe this guy's. It's like, it's hard to explain, but it's like, I can't believe the – you know, the craziness that this guy's trying to kill himself, whatever.
And they were really lucky that this show kind of happened when it did in history. Like, the concussion and steroid stuff hadn't happened yet, and, like, wouldn't for a couple of years. Everyone was still into, like, the crazy hits and violence. And I think we knew, like, it wasn't good for guys because of all the neck surges we had seen. But I think the concussion stuff wasn't fully...
Right, the sick chair shots really are really jarring when you watch them now. It's like,
oh. Right, and at the time it was like right at the edge of the cliff, getting that show in that moment. Yeah. Scott, what did you think of this one?
It was fantastic. I one guy that I always liked, and you know, I don't have a lot of knowledge of Japanese wrestling. I really don't. But one guy that I did always like when I would watch like tapes or read about him in magazines was Tanaka. Just because he was such a different kind of guy from the other guys that were, you know, he was different from Muda or you know, anybody or Chono or anybody like that. Like, he was just such a different Japanese wrestler. I was always fascinated by him. And seeing him here, I remember at the time I was really excited and maybe hoping maybe that Vince would sign him and he'd be like a mysterious guy for somebody, you know, on either show. And it was just – it was incredible. It was really incredible. I mean, I get Joey's – taking the one line aside, I get Joey's anger. I mean, it's a very emotional night. And here was a guy who took – who was handed something and then trashed it. So – and here's Foley. This may be next to the opening match. This is where Foley annoyed me too. I understand – Mick, that the match was really good and you want to cut the guy some slack. But you know what? This pissed Joey off. I mean, it was at the tail end. The company was struggling to begin with in 2000. And here's this guy who's like, oh, I'm champion, but fuck it, I'm getting a check. And it pissed him off. So I can understand Joey's frustration. You know,
Guys think it was legit anger or was he just laying it off?
Oh, no, he was definitely pissed. Yeah. Oh, he was definitely pissed.
I think he was doing the Scott Criscolo. I think he was. There was some rooted anger there, but I think he played it up for the I think he played it up a little bit for the gimmick. But, I mean, I think he probably was really mad and really wanted to vent. And I'm sure Heyman fed him a little bit and got him fired up a bit. Like, I think it was rooted in truth, but I definitely think he played it up for the show.
Yeah.
I'm sure looking back he regrets that line, poor Joey.
I feel like he's talked about it since. I don't remember where it was.
Yeah. I feel like he's talked about it too. Yeah, I feel like he's talked about it too. But the match itself is fantastic. I mean, they kill each other. I mean, no,
just
again,
a spectacle.
No,
and we didn't even mention the great that they resurrected Awesome Bomb the song. So just hearing that play as we're getting the replays and all that. Just like...
And Mick is like trashing his WCW gimmicks, the like fat chicks. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, that would have been great if he came out with the 70s. He came out with a couple of fatties. That would have been awesome.
I actually thought of you for some reason today, Tavano, when he said he's loving the fat chicks.
Hey, whoever says yes.
But that was funny. That was funny. But yeah, you could definitely tell Mick was – or Joey was – he probably amped it up a little bit, yeah, but most of it was not fake, the emotion. But the match itself was fantastic.
Oh,
it was fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I thought for sure they were going to give Awesome a job, but, I mean, looking back, where would he really have fit? I mean, it's not like he had a technical masterpiece. I mean, it was really just a trash garbage match, and they weren't really doing, like, hardcore stuff at this point.
Right.
I mean, I don't know.
You know, Vince wouldn't have signed off. His body was a little soft and a little doughy. You know, Vince wouldn't.
And this is like peak steroid time too, right here. This is not like the time he was like into hiring chubby guys. You know, this was
fat shaming. There we go.
Yeah, big time. I mean, this was like this was hardcore. Like everyone is, you know, jacked and juiced.
Yep.
So, you know, the guy busted his ass, gave a memorable moment, but probably aided in his.
Yeah. Like I said, when they both came out, I was because of that, you know, because at that time, like I said, everybody was ripped. So when these two guys came out, I'm like, oh, these two guys are, you know, looking a little soft. You don't expect much. And then it turned out to be an awesome match.
Agreed. I mean, who knew what to expect? Yeah. At the least you thought maybe, all right, they'll unload some chair shots and that'll be it. But you didn't expect them to just go this crazy. And that last dive is so great with that camera shot that completely misses it. You know, you just hear him like slam into the table out of nowhere.
One point I want to talk about before we move on. It was another thing when I was looking at our old review on the board. Everyone was saying like they were getting in the match, but a lot of people thought that JBL was still kind of ripping it, and like he was apparently saying like, oh, look at this technical masterpiece. And so I think a lot of people. I'm sure deep down they probably did like it, but I don't think they were as openly rooting for it, even though they said it on the show, as it was. I think JBL was still kind of shitting on it, even though it looked like he wasn't. I don't know. I was just kind
of. I mean, maybe a little bit, but I think he's playing it up. I mean, I don't think of all the guys there, like even though he's being a bully, like I don't think JBL really believes some of the shit they were doing. Like I think he seemed the kind of guy that kind of knows his history and stuff. Like I don't think he was. I mean, you know, you always hear like Bischoff and others that were like really against it. I don't know. JBL doesn't scream it to me. This seems fully just in character for him. I mean, I think his character is an extension of him, his asshole self, but I don't think like he really hated
that's true.
These guys.
Sure.
I mean, I think he was just playing it up.
Mm-hmm. Well, then we get the moment in the show.
Yes.
That,
the big one.
Everybody was looking forward to.
So Paul Heyman finally comes out. You wondered if he was going to or not, or if he was just going to stay in the back. He comes out. He's got his trademark big trench coat. Gives a tremendous heartfelt moment, thanks to loyal fans, all the staff, and then turns his attention to the Crusaders and starts with Eric Bischoff, goes on to Edge with the Matt freaking Hardy, and then JBL with the Killer. The only reason you were world champion for as long as you were is because Triple H didn't want to work Tuesdays. And that was like just like a big thing at the time because everyone on the internet like hated JBL's title reign. And that was like, yeah, fuck you, scrub, you know, like, like, do you ever think of Triple H would be like, you know, yeah, Triple H, you don't want to work your night. Like, that's why like everyone's back at him. Watching back, I don't know. What did you think of the insults? Because I kind of cringed at the Matt freaking Hardy thing. Like, Heyman built it up like it was this big zinger, and it just was like, all right. You know,
because the best was he's like, I got two words, and then Matt freaking Hardy, and then like Edge and all them had like three fingers up, Bill. Like, that's three words, you idiot.
And like, he does it like, I don't know, he's like, does like all those weird like hand motions, like he's prepping himself. And it's just, I know at the time it was a big deal because like it was such a taboo thing to talk about Matt. And like they were refusing to hire him back at this point, and it was like such a big story. So it was—I mean, it was a big deal at the time for him to say that. Well, looking back, it seems so hokey and like cringeworthy when he says it. It's like Matt freaking Hardy, like okay,
like well, whatever, okay. And just like spitting beer out of his mouth or whatever.
Right,
like,
right.
It was ridiculous.
And also, he said, you know, when he got came out and he got emotional. He said, "I'm not crying. I was in the back smoking a joint with Van Damme."
Yeah, yeah. Right.
That was funny.
And then Bischoff flips off Heyman, and JBL mimics the bouncing checks. I thought that was pretty funny.
Yes, that was very funny, yeah.
But emotional promo was very needed on the show. Heyman gets a massive ovation, continues the storyline with the Crusaders, and it lets Heyman, similar to RVD, kind of vent, get some of the stuff off his chest. But again, guys he's going to work with and go back to, so it was like, all right, well, be careful what you say a little bit, you know. I know
It's funny now, you think it's no big deal, but back then, you know, that Tuesday's comment was kind of a big deal, like, ooh, he broke kayfabe or whatever, but, you know, now it's like everybody, you know, shoots and tells the truth. But
I thought I had read somewhere that JBL got legitimately pissed off at that, too, which is why he he took liberties later, which we'll get into in a minute. But
oh, yeah.
Yeah, he may
have. It was a big thing, yeah.
Because Heyman even does, like, do you want to shoot cowboy thing or whatever, and then he goes on from there. So, all right, main event time, Scott.
Main event, pretty much the last guys left we haven't seen yet, all in one match. One of them, a team that I think was going to leave soon, but we've been kind of bashing JR in our last like year of reviews, and that is Bubba Ray and D-Von, the Dudley Boys, who we had been saying for maybe the last year of regular WWE pay-per-views have been really stale and really dull. But this was a perfect showcase for them, and they came out in their awesome old-school tie-dye, missing sign guy, and one of the other 50 Dudley kids. And that their partners, though, probably the faces of the promotion. One of them, of course, Tommy Dreamer, and a great line I think it was Joey who said, if Paul was the brains and somebody was something else.
He was the voice. He said, if I was the voice.
Oh, yeah. If I'm the voice and Paul's the brains, then Tommy is the heart and soul.
Right.
And that was exactly. And the guts. And, of course, the other guy, the other face, what many probably called the Stone Cold of ECW. And that was, of course, Sandman. And, of course, he came out to the music and everything. But we'll get to that in a minute. Plenty of notes on this match, JR.
Yes, lots.
A myriad of notes. Go ahead.
So the final appearance for the whole Dudley family, surprisingly enough, after being released on July 5th, it was revealed that WWE informed Bubba and D-Von they now own the trademark to their in-ring names. They had not, because they had purchased it when they bought the bankrupt assets of ECW. And Scott, I remember still the day this house cleaning happened. I think we'll talk more about this probably in our next review, but they had that massive firing on July 5th. And I remember coming to your desk and like you were teasing me like, try and guess the names, and like I remember being shocked that the Dudleys were in that group that got released because it just seemed like it would never happen. Like they seemed like they were gonna be there forever,
right?
Because they were, even though they were stale, they were perpetually over. So in September, Bubba and D-Von signed deals with TNA where they were forced to assume the names Brother Ray and Brother D-Von as of 2010, or Devin, I guess. As of 2010, they continued to compete in TNA's tag division. Their little brother Spike was also released on July 5th. He would work the Northeast Indies scenes before also heading to TNA as Brother Runt. Remained there to 07 when he returned to the indie scene as a competitor and trainer. And eventually, I think at this point now he's done with the business. The Dudley Boys' final record as a team is 16-27, going 2-3 at the Rumble, 0-4 at WrestleMania, 1-1 at King of the Ring, 2-2 at SummerSlam and Survivor Series, 9-15 at other events. Best year was 01, going 9-2. So take that out. And they were, what, 5-25 outside of 2001. Bubba's pay-per-view record is himself. He was 3-0 in 2002. The record goes to 19-27. Pretty surprising record. And, of course, the Dudleys recently returned to WWE after a very long layoff of 10 years. Returned. Bubba returned at the Rumble this year, and then they returned as a team in the fall. But surprising record for them. And, you know, this is it, Scott, talking about them. So their run has been an interesting one. I think, you know, we talked all night about guys not reaching their potential. I think they completely overreached their potential. I mean, when you looked at the way they started with still doing the tie-dye and stuttering gimmick, it seemed like they may flame out quickly. They reinvented themselves very fast with the look and the attitude. They started putting women through tables, and I got them over, and then it was on from there. And then eventually just kind of got stale and faded. They had the little bump with the heel return, but really kind of going nowhere. And retrospect, not a surprise they got cut, but at the time was very shocking.
It was pretty shocking because you would have figured they were like a foundation tag team and could have kept, because we've been saying consistently on our other vaults that both tag divisions on both shows are pretty awful at this point. So cutting them loose, I thought, I remember we were talking back then that that was, it was definitely a big shock because you really couldn't afford to cut tag teams. What'd you think, John, quick, when they cut the Dudleys loose? I was pretty stunned, just like JR was, because there really wasn't much tag team action going on either show. Maybe that's why.
Yeah, they were getting away from tag teams. I guess they figured they went as far as they can with them. I mean, like you said, these guys exceeded expectations. So and the pay-per-views were kind of getting away from tag teams, unfortunately. So.
Yeah.
So I was as shocked as you guys, but
yeah, it was. I thought that they'd be there for a while. I mean, maybe if the singles run in 2002 had worked a little bit. I mean, Devon's gimmick was stupid, but yeah, I thought maybe if. Yeah, maybe if Bubba's in 02 on Raw had gone, had some traction, maybe they'd have stuck him around. But realizing that the you know that they had already tried splitting him up once and failed miserably, why bother? So you might as well just cut him loose and let him make money elsewhere. So,
all right. So, Sandman making his debut, another longtime ECW stalwart, Jim Fillington joined ECW in 1993, playing a surfer turned wrestler portraying the Sandman. After ditching the surfer gimmick, he briefly played up a pimp gimmick, and they began to have a long time, began to have a relationship with a longtime wrestling valet woman escort him to the ring. He was a multi-time heavyweight champion, involved in many memorable storylines, with the most popular being, including his ex-wife and his son being brainwashed by Raven. In 1999, had that brief run in WCW's Hardcore Hack. Quickly nosedived, migrated back to ECW in 2000, stayed there till the promotion closed, and then spent time in XPW and TNA before being brought in here. Surprising to me, too, all the guys we talk about all stayed till the end, most of them. Like, everyone we talk about was there at the end, which is surprising, because all you think of is all these guys that left ECW. But also see quickly the debut of Axel Rotten, who interferes in the match before he gets going. Axel began training in 1986, would work the Northeast scene along his fictional brother Ian. Axel would have a very brief stop in WCW and a longer visit in GWF before heading to ECW in 93, on and off there, before finally leaving in 99. Joining him is Balls Mahoney. Balls was training at the age of 15 in 1987 prior to working the indie scene in the early 90s. Joined SMW in 94 as Boo Bradley. WWF in 95 as Santa Claus. Would find his biggest success in 97 under the name Balls Mahoney in ECW, where he stayed until it closed up. Also making her debut, the Queen of Extreme, Francine, debuted in ECW in 1995 after training at the House of Hardcore for 2 years. Most famous role in the promotion was as Shane Douglas's manager. After Douglas left in 99, she would spend time in the corner of Tommy Dreamer and then Just Incredible, where she remained until ECW closed. Brief stint in TNA in 2002 and then returned here for the show. Teresa Hayes started her career with a brief appearance in Stampede in 1988, dating Brian Pillman at the time. In 1995, headed to ECW as Beulah McGillicuddy, booked as a former childhood friend of Tommy Dreamer and Raven. Story was that she was a fat teenager in love with Tommy, but he ignored her, so she slept with Raven instead. Stevie Richards was brought in for ECW to help Raven vanquish Dreamer. In 1996, Beulah claimed she was pregnant with Tommy's baby and left Raven to manage Dreamer. She would remain by Dreamer's side until 1998 when she was ready to leave the business. She was written out with a broken neck courtesy of a Dudley Boys 3D and did not appear on TV since until this show. They would marry in 2002. Quick note as well, in the post-match brawl that we'll talk about, there was a nasty incident with JBL and the Blue Meanie. Based on a few reports, Meany and JBL had heat from Meany's previous stint in the WWF back in 1999. After being released, Meany ripped into JBL in various interviews. According to JBL, Meany was shooting on him prior to the brawl in the ring. The tape shows JBL targeting Meany and peppering him with legit punches to the face, bloodying him and opening up fresh stitches. Other wrestlers contend that JBL was fuming over Heyman's comments earlier in the night, and that he assaulted the weakest target in the ring, unprofessionally taking liberties on Meany. If you continue to review the tape, you can see JBL get stomped down, and Bubba actually saves him by pulling him out of the ring. There were reports that the office was angry at JBL, but nothing came of the incident, as Vince didn't really care about Meany's well-being. Backing up his friend, legit tough guy Tracy Smothers later challenged JBL to a fight, but that challenge went unanswered. In an attempt to avoid a potential lawsuit, WWE hired Blue Meany shortly after the show, and on the 7-7 SmackDown, Meany and JBL squared off in a match that saw Stevie Richards gain revenge for his friend by crushing JBL with a vicious chair shot. Richards later verified that it was a receipt for the pay-per-view assault. Meany would win the match, and the incident would quickly blow over, and we'll talk more about him going forward. So, Dudley's in their old gear. Good choice for the main event. Dreamer had to be in the main event, like we said. So did Sandman. We get the epic Sandman entrance, and I'm going to pause here, D'Amato, because this is a huge part of the show. Tell us about this moment live.
Well, first the notes, you know, Jason Greenhouse would have been in heaven, Enter Sandman from Metallica, and the whole crowd just sang every word of the song, word for word. And all of a sudden, Sandman in the balcony, just, you know, just going crazy, pulling beers. He must have had like 20 beers in his pants, just pulling them out and cracking them over the head, busting his head open, beer all over the place from the balcony, and just making his way down. It was the longest. You know, and that's probably why, as we'll see, he hardly wrestled in the match because he was worn out from just the entrance, just making his way from the balcony and just kept pulling beers out and whacking himself. It was, and like I said, the crowd sung every word of Enter Sandman, just epic, man.
And sadly, they obviously didn't use the song in future releases, so unless you recorded it, tape, I mean, you'll never see that. But yeah, the crowd singing is what I remember the most from it, just...
Everywhere,
yeah, it was awesome.
Beginning to end, and like I said, just from the way he came from, you know, from the balcony, you know how the Hammerstein is, and he made his way down, just pulling beers out left and right.
He poured the one beer down that guy's throat from like the guy was standing on the floor, and he was pouring it from the fucking
right. And
second
then of course,
whatever.
My favorite part when he made his way down, he found the nice blonde who beer all over her chest, and he gave her a motorboat.
And that was
And then him and Dreamer found another one, and they did a double motorboat to another dude.
And that was Electra, former ECW valet. Sandman's gut, by the way, was massive. I mean, he's like just hanging over his pants.
Yeah, by the time he got down, I was like, you know, he wasn't going to wrestle much of that because he looked worn out. But he was cooked already. Like, he must have had pants, these cargo pants, like 20 pockets, because he kept pulling beers out left and right.
So CW Anderson and Chris Chetty also ringside. They toast beers. Dreamer drinks the beer off Electra's tits. Sandman spews beer towards the Crusaders, and then in a real classy moment, Maverick's jacking off the kendo stick at them.
Yes.
It's like, look at this fucking guy.
This entire 6 minute moment is the greatest moment. 6 minutes of this whole show.
Like, to me, that just completely justifies the thoughts of every anti ECW guy. Like, this slob out there, like jerking off a kendo stick, drunk off his ass.
Well, he just motorboated some chick.
This is an ECW main event, a typical man. Yeah.
This slob. Look at this fucking bum. The BWO comes out, this is a great touch. The crowd loved it. Stevie super kicks Sandman, and you get a big brawl to start the match. And of course, they had Simon Dean dressed as Nova, which was cool. Nova takes some gross chair shots that we'll talk about in a moment. So Kid Cash, Balls Mahoney, Axel Rotten all come out. Great ECW style stuff. Tons of other guys showing up for a big fight. Nova takes some gross chair shots from Balls and Axel. Cash hits a big springboard somersault into everyone. And Joey gets a funny line here because of Mr. TNA, total nonstop attitude. The match finally gets underway. All the weapons come out. Dreamer tries to use the cheese grater on Bubba, but gets blocked. We get some stiff shots with trash cans. And then Bubba finally uses the grater on Dreamer, and we get nasty, nasty blood. Dreamer gets hit with a double team neck breaker by the Dudleys. Sandman uses a ladder to take them both out, and the Dreamer does the Terry Funk ladder spot where he spins around and then uses the grater on Bubba. Bubba's bleeding as well. The Dudleys work over Sandman. Bubba hits a second rope frog splash onto Sandman on the ladder. The Impact players come out to take over. Just Incredible hits a tombstone into the barbed wire on Sandman. Francine comes out and kicks Tommy Lowe. Beulah comes out to a massive pop and triggers a cat fight. Cat fight! Perfect booking to give ECW fans everything they want. The cat fight, Beulah's return. Like I mentioned, you know, it was crazy how she never came back after that neck injury. Impact players get cleared out. Dreamer and Beulah embrace, and you get the Dreamer bleeding all over Beulah's hair and suit. They hit stereo DDTs on the Dudleys, which normally I would have hated, but I let it go here. Because, like, Bubba drops before Beulah even, like, snaps her down. It's, like, so bad. Bubba uses the kendo stick for a comeback and pulls out a table. Sandman gets powerbombed through the table for a near fall. We get the 3D on Dreamer, and then another table comes out, and the arena starts to buzz as Spike comes out with his old glasses and kind of mentally challenged gimmick thing that he had going on. He's got lighter fluid and a lighter. The Dudley set the table on fire, powerbomb Tommy through it for a monster pop. And I would say, to this point, the craziest spot in pay-per-view history for the WWE. Wild, very fitting ECW-style brawl. It couldn't have been booked any better. I thought it was interesting that the Dudleys got the big win, but I guess, you know, ECW folklore is a Dreamer must always lose the big one. Sandman saves Beulah from the Dudleys, which is a nice callback to Beulah's injury since the Dudleys are the ones that had taken her out. So, Scott, your thoughts on the match, and then John will get your live thoughts.
It was ECW. That was ECW in a nutshell. That match. I mean, when he rips the cheese grater over Tommy's face, it's like, holy fucking shit. I mean, it was, and he was just pouring blood. And all these chairs and just these stiff chair shots. I remember the guy I marked out for the most because I never thought I'd ever see him again was Axel Rotten. I'm like, where the fuck did they get him from? Oh, my God.
Yeah, he looked like he had Sandman's gut times 20.
Oh, my God. Yeah, they were just at the buffet. But, I mean, it was crazy. And, it was incredible. It was absolutely incredible. And then, of course, you know, setting the table on fire, and it was insane. It was absolutely insane. Fitting last match. I mean, they booked it perfectly. John?
Yeah, the guys
for you must have been crazy.
Oh, yeah. Some of the guys, you know, around us were mentioning that there was no blood all night. And I guess we see why not, because they're sure saving it for this. I mean, when Bubba with the cheese grater on Dreamer, and then Bubba, you know, wipes the blood on his own face. And then just Dreamer, his face is just a crimson mask, and you know, and Beulah she just went right in for the hug. She didn't care, and she got all over her hair, and it was just, you know, one spot after the other, the tables, but like I said, the Dudley's got the win, but I, at this stage, I don't think wins and losses, you know, nobody's really to pay attention, and of course, you know, they got the cat fight. That's what everybody wanted. And,
yeah, it was a nice touch.
They delivered on everything. It was just like a whole history of ECW all in a 10-minute match, man.
And it was
every spot imaginable.
And it was cool that Beulah and Francine be the women that fight, too, because they're...
The cat fight, yeah.
They're probably the most synonymous women-wise. I mean, you know, you had Sonny and a few others that were well-known there. But, I mean, to me, those are the two that were like the ECW, you know, lifers, you know, Beulah and Francine. So it was fitting that they're the ones that had the big cat fight in the main event. And yeah, the Dudleys winning, I think, was solely to do the fire spot. I mean, that's the only reason they won. It was just surprising because they were gone. You know, they were getting cut. So it's kind of funny to see them win. But yeah, I mean, a wild, crazy, fantastic main event. Everything you would have wanted as an ECW fan, right down to the crazy run-ins and overbooking to open the thing and getting to see all your favorites. Like I said, I thought it was cool that the BWO came out. So after the match, Sandman calls for a beer. Steve Austin comes out to drink it with him. Austin comes out with the full Stone Cold music and the look, and it felt a little too WWE, but I get why they couldn't. Like, if they're doing the beer bash, you kind of have to have Austin be that way, but, like, part of me wishes they could have just, I don't know, Jesus Christ Superstar, anything, like, just to make it a little bit different. Like, it just felt so Stone Cold-y and so WWE. I don't know.
I think that was, you know, Vince's way of reminding, hey, we gave you guys, you know, your night, but this is still, you know, my company, and, you know, it's still about us.
Yeah, and I think part of it, too, is just, though, like, how do you bring Austin back to that time frame? Like, he can't grow his hair. I think the music would have been it, yeah. And I guess
I would have killed for Jesus Christ Superstar in the orange tank top, but I knew you needed to have... And come on, JR, you marked out at the old Vegas Outlaws jersey. Come
yeah,
on.
How old is that thing? I mean, that thing was beat to hell.
Certainly disintegrated.
So they have the beer bash. You get a lot of ECW stars come out, even some that weren't on the show itself. Austin says he wants to see a fight, and he calls out the Crusaders to come square off in the ring after running their mouths all night. He picks on Angle a lot, just dumps on Angle. Kurt Angle, you mealy-mouthed bastard. Just like ripping him hardcore. Austin gets a beer and sits at ringside waiting for the brawl, and then he finally baits them to come down. Taz comes out with his old music and look at the towel over his head because, of course, like we talked about, he had gotten beaten down on SmackDown. So that's one last big moment, one last big surprise. You get him coming out with the old song. Bischoff jumps into the booth to announce with Styles and Foley, and Styles just lays into him for being a shitty announcer in WCW and Nitro.
Yeah, that was funny.
Just trashes him hard. We get a big brawl that erupts as the crowd's going nuts. Angle and Taz fight on the floor as Angle gets choked out. JBL fucks up the meanie with the cheap shots, like we mentioned. And then JBL gets smacked around, and Bubba eventually pulls him out of the ring to save him. ECW team wins. The Crusaders go to the floor and then leave. Austin calls for Bischoff. Foley carries him to the ring. And then I still love that the Austin Bischoff feud like rages on, like even in this world, still going. Sandman stumbling around drunk, like completely out of his ass. It was good for Bischoff to show ass too, as he always takes, as always, he takes a bunch of finishes from all the guys. Ray's poor 619 is booed again here.
Oh my God.
Throughout the euphoria of this moment, they still boo this poor guy for doing the move. Bischoff still proclaims WCW is the best, and then he eats a stunner. I thought that was a great moment, too. Show closes with a big beer bash as the Dudleys carry Bischoff to the back and leave him on a flatbed truck. I kind of like how the Dudleys were like the protector liaisons. Like, they save JBL. They're the ones that take Bischoff out, so maybe no one takes any liberties with him. They kind of protect him and get him out of there. And then you get the big celebration. My final thoughts, a real emotional show, unlike any other WWE pay-per-view in history, a wild night, all-time classic, A+. The crowd was unbelievable, perfect booking. You couldn't have structured it any better. You know, maybe missing one or two guys, a Shane Douglas, a Terry Funk, you know, here or there, that would have maybe made the night complete. RVD not wrestling. But across the board, you couldn't have asked for any more on a WWE-produced show. John, what are your thoughts of the beer bash and final thoughts of the night?
Well, the final thought is it was just an amazing spectacle. I mean, it was just one of those rare nights where on a pay-per-view where wins and losses and belts and all that didn't matter. It's just about the spectacle and just paying tribute to a great, you know, moment in history, a great company in history, ECW, which, you know, a lot of the stuff that they invented, you know, we still watch and enjoy today. Just an amazing spectacle. And where the crowd, it was just all, I would say it was 99%. Positive, except for Rey Mysterio, unfortunately. But otherwise, I mean, the crowd just enjoyed everything, and they were a big part of the night. They were just there. They wanted to pay tribute to ECW, and they weren't, you know, there to chant, like, you know, boring and be dicks. They just wanted to, you know, enjoy what they had with ECW. And also, it didn't mean shitting on the current product. So it was just a great spectacle.
What do you think, Scott?
I mean, There's not many shows, pay-per-views that I would throw in anytime, anywhere, and watch. I mean, WrestleMania 3, No Way Out 01, WrestleMania 17 probably, Bash 89. This goes there as well. I could put this show on whenever I want, and it'll always make me smile and put me in a good mood. I mean, it's just a top to bottom, you could not find a better booked show for nostalgia purposes and just pure entertainment. From the heels, I mean, let's be honest, guys. We got to give JBL and Kurt and Bischoff a lot of credit because, I mean, they, who knows what psycho whack jobs in that building. I mean, somebody could have got shanked in the hallway. I mean, I give them a lot of credit for walking around freely. And, yeah, there was security, but still, I mean, to walk around freely when clearly – particularly Bischoff. You know, JBL and Kurt, I think it was more storyline to a certain extent. But, old school ECW legitimately despises Eric Bischoff. Legitimately despises him. To Eric Bischoff, ECW is nothing more than a feeder to steal guys. They had no redeeming qualities whatsoever except for a few guys he could steal and stick in a shit feud on Nitro. That's And to be able to – and to have the guts to walk around there and not worry that if I was going to go take a leak in the can that I was going to get fucking shanked, it says a lot about them. And having said that, on this night, nothing didn't work. Maybe a couple things didn't work. But otherwise, everything worked perfectly. And in a time capsule, in a vacuum, like you said, this is one of those shows that honestly I could put on any time. and just smile when I watch it.
And it's just amazing.
There's not a lot of shows like that.
It still just amazes me that they allowed this to happen. I mean, it's especially at this time period. Like, there's no network, no classic. Well, I guess Classic of the Man just started. But, you know, it's like I just never expected it. Never expected it. Like, there was nothing in Vince's history that thought this would ever happen. Like, the invasion, you know, they slaughtered everything. And, like, nothing since. And, I mean, thankfully that DVD did well and RVD spoke up and it led to this. But, I mean, I don't think in anyone's wildest dreams they could have imagined it would go this well, even until, you know, the minute we sat down at 8 o'clock or whatever time it started, did we ever imagine that this was coming.
Right.
And also, who would have thought that the awesome Tanaka match would have been the one that, you know, everybody was talking about over the Benoit Guerrero match, which is an upset in itself.
And I know we don't usually do this with the full card, but we also don't usually have this many great matches, so... How would you rank the card from top to bottom? I think I would go probably awesome Tanaka, then the main event, Sabu Rhino third, Super Crazy fourth, Storm fifth. Well, no, Benoit fifth, Storm Jericho sixth, Rey Psychosis. Probably the worst match of the night, I guess.
Yeah.
You guys disagree at all on that?
Maybe I will put the Tajiri one a little higher, probably like up to third.
Above Sabu and Rhino?
Yeah. Just because of the super crazy moonsault. Mm.
I kind of like your order, JR. I mean, I really liked Sabu Rhino. And I would have, I think before our show, I loved Eddie Benoit, and I still do, but the points we talked about tonight, it's very makes a lot of sense that match had even more promise, and it didn't, and not as much delivered as it could have. So
in every match, 10:52 or less, only two matches over 10 minutes. One was close third, the rest all 6-7. So very evenly spread out show. Obviously, lots of vignettes and other stuff, but. Flew by. I mean, it still flies by.
Yep.
Watching it today. So, obviously, if you've never seen it, which I don't know if that's possible, if you haven't seen it, it's a must watch. Check it out.
Exactly.
Right. Epic.
Have to watch it. Have to.
Perfect time capsule. And, I mean, did you guys think ECW was dead at this point? Did you think it was over? Or did you think maybe there was a sniff of something else could happen?
At the time, I thought this was it. Particularly after all the
me too. I never would have thought they would have came. You know, they would have had to follow through with the weekly TV show. I just think it was a one shot deal.
Considering all the liberties that certain people took on that show, I'm sure Vince wasn't overly thrilled. I mean, I'm sure he knew it was coming,
but they had a figure. I mean, it did so well. You would think
they might have kicked the tires, but they had a lot going on in 05, so maybe they didn't realize where they could have put it. I mean, we'll get more into this, JR, you know, as we move along in the calendar year into 06. But, I mean, I'm sure they might have kicked the tires on it, but I don't think they really thought about it until they moved into the new year. But like I said, we'll get more into it as we move along.
Okay. All right, well, that'll do it for us here tonight. Ton of fun talking to that show. I want to thank Mr. D'Amato for joining us for the first time ever inside the Vintage Vault. Great job.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, guys. Loved it.
Scott will be back in 2 weeks' time with Vengeance, another great show.
We're
on quite the run here.
It just gets better. Yeah.
So we'll talk about that. Like I said, a Dangerous Alliance coming this week, I believe, in main events.
Yes.
Everyone enjoy your Thanksgiving weekend. Like we said, one of the best weeks of the year. New Kevin Kelly show next week as well. So until then, we'll talk in 2 weeks' time. Everyone take care. D'Amato goes extreme.
Peace, bitches.
D'Amato. Be a soaked booers.
D'Amato after dark.
Come on.
Motorboat those hooey.